It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo! I am a one-man wrecking crew.
Welcome to episode 613 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 18th, 2019. I am the Solid Monster, getting over a nasty cold on the mend, so hopefully all of you are feeling a lot better than I am right now. Audible, I know I'm feeling pretty good about Audible, because they're still offering all of you guys a free book as part of your 30-day trial, so get on it. audibletrial.com/Solid Monster, sign up, 30 days, sample the service. And you get one free audiobook of your choosing. A lot of good wrestling books up there. I've suggested before, you know, Bob Holly, Daniel Bryan, Hulk Hogan in the fiction section. All those good books are up there, and you can get them for free, one of them, by using our link. So again, jump on that. Also want to say thank you right off the bat to all of our PayPal VIPs, all of you who help really keep this thing going more than anything else. Just your support is incredible. So if you want to make a donation, you can do so. It's totally voluntary. You can go to thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Thank you again, by the way, for the review for my mother's book that you left on Amazon. Those are always very helpful, so my thank you to Paul. Deadpool James Herrera, John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissara, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Keith the Conqueror Krajnik, Killshot Keith Hart, look at that, back-to-back Keiths, Brett Brickfist Brode, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Recon Russell Bulware, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Anthony Law and Order Obasi, the Musical Mercenary, Hisham Dahoud. Hopefully I always worry when I pronounce some of these names that I'm going to botch them somehow, but I think I nailed that one. So my thank you to Hisham. Number one, Nikolai Wagner, which was sent in by his father, Gary Wagner. I want to give a shout out to both of them. Thank you very much for the support. And Rob, who had been planning to buy a copy of The Adventure of Hardy the Horse to read to his daughter, Elia, and eventually her little brother Mason, and came home to find a copy of the book already waiting for him that his friend Jamie had bought for his daughter. His friend is also a Sound Off listener for about 8 years now. So how about that? He was going to buy the book, and his friend went and bought it for him, completely unbeknownst to him. So big shout out to Jamie. Jamie Motho Dutton in Manchester. That's a hell of a friend, Rob, that you've got there. The book should ship out right away to people from Amazon. I got a couple of questions about that. I know there was a bit of a delay for some people. People were putting in orders, and it was saying that it would get to them in 3 weeks. Because there was they were waiting for some new books to get. I guess it's a good problem to have, but everything is back to normal now. The books are stocked and ready to ship, for those of you who did ask me about that, so everything should be fine now. So thank you for that, and also want to give one quick iTunes shout-out to Vincent H713, who left a very kind review for the podcast in iTunes, so thank you for that. For those of you who may have missed it, I recorded almost 20 minutes on the G1 finals that I posted on YouTube during the week, not only talking about that great final match between Kota Ibushi and Jay White, but the tremendous angle that they shot with Kenta turning heel and joining Bullet Club, then getting attacked by Katsuyori Shibata, who nobody even knew was there. They didn't even know he was in the building. They didn't know he was in Japan. You know, because he does a lot of training at the LA dojo that they have. And out comes Shibata, and it was just this fantastic angle. And nobody, again, we haven't seen Shibata get physical like that since the match with Okada 2 years ago, after which they had to remove part of his skull to operate on his brain. He had brain surgery. That's how serious that injury was that he suffered. But he came out here. He looked to be in great shape, and he hit a lot of his, you know, took his shirt off, was jumping around. He hit a lot of his trademark spots. before being beaten down. No shots to the head, of course, but he was beaten down by Kenta and Bullet Club, and this great parting shot at the end of Kenta sitting cross-legged on Shibata's chest. The heat that these men got for this angle was just absolutely off the charts. Genuine, pure hatred. Not just for the turn, but what they did to Shibata. And it made you want to see Shibata wrestle Kenta in the worst way, maybe at the Tokyo Dome. But it doesn't sound like that is in the plans. It doesn't sound like that may even be possible, because they won't clear him. You know, selfishly, I hope they find a way. But I also don't want the man to die. So, if it's not possible, then it's not possible. Obviously, you know, you're not going to put your own entertainment over someone's health and well-being. So if they can't do it, they can't do it. But if you want my full review, you can find it on the YouTube channel. We just passed 52,000 subscribers on there, so thank you for that. And my full SummerSlam review from last Sunday is up there as well. And also, I did push it out to the feed, so lots of different ways to listen to that as an extra for those of you who may have missed it. We start with All Elite Wrestling. AEW is on a roll after selling out their first TNT taping in Washington, D.C. to the tune of over 10,000 seats. They had back-to-back sellouts of their next two sets of TVs, the October 9th show in Boston and the October 16th show in Philadelphia. It only took them about an hour to do so. The Boston show set up for about 4,500 people. The Philly show configured for about 7,700. And already announced for week two is Jon Moxley against Shawn Spears. And as previously mentioned, the Young Bucks in a rematch from last week's House of Glory show against Private Party, which I believe is part of the AEW Tag Team Title Tournament. And week three in Philly, we'll see the first defenses of the AEW World Championship and the Women's Championship as well. And I would say this, because again, every time there's a big AEW story or they sell out or nearly sell out, you get a lot of people who are very excited and very happy for them. And then you have the brigade that just does not like AEW, or they think it's so overhyped they can't get behind it, and you know, they find any way to knock it down. Let's just appreciate how impressive this truly is here just for a second. You can appreciate how impressive it is for them to sell the number of tickets that they sold in 1 hour the other day, even with whatever scalpers may have picked up tickets. I mean, look, if they have a building that's configured for 7,700 people, you didn't have 7,700 scalpers buying tickets. Whatever that number is, it's still impressive. And you can recognize that while also recognizing that AEW is still in the honeymoon phase with fans. And people have to admit that as well. You know, we also have yet to see how tickets are going to sell on the West Coast. These are all East Coast shows. DC, Boston, Philly. This is all East Coast. You know, and I would say East Coast is probably the strongest area for wrestling in this country. I mean, you've got wrestling all over the place. But I would say the East Coast is probably the safest and maybe easy. I don't want to say easy, but I'm sure there's some independent promoters listening to this going, easy. Easy. I wouldn't say it's easy to sell tickets, but that is just a wrestling hotbed. We have yet to see how they would do if they had a show out in California, or in Nevada, or any of those places, Arizona, Texas, or the middle of the country, for that matter. But selling out their first three TVs, including two of them within 1 hour, that's something that you can't put down. You cannot diminish that. You know how many promotions have sprouted and started up? And now, granted, they didn't have the kind of money in the television that AEW has. But so many promotions have come and gone. They've opened, they've folded. You know, this is something that we haven't seen in a very long time. And in time, we'll see if they can do the same when they run bigger buildings, because these are not the biggest buildings that they're running. So that's another element to this as well. It's nice that they can pack in, you know, a building that, once the stage and everything is set up, can fit 6,000 or 7,000. But what about a building that can accommodate 16 or 17,000? You know, we haven't seen that yet either. But I say this, you got to crawl before you can walk. You have to walk before you can run. But so far, so good. And speaking of Jon Moxley, according to Sports Illustrated, Moxley's deal with New Japan Pro Wrestling, this is a question that I had watching him progress in the G1, and of course he has the United States Championship, and I figure, well, he may have to drop that before they go to TNT, and maybe that'll be the end of his run in New Japan. It would be a shame, because he seems to be having fun, and I've enjoyed, you know, watching the majority of his matches so far, and the way he's matched up with some of these guys in New Japan. So we come to find out, according to Sports Illustrated, that his deal with New Japan is said to run all the way through the Tokyo Dome at the beginning of January. At least that first, remember, they're doing back-to-back nights in the Dome, January 4th and 5th. And according to this report, his deal extends through the January 4th Dome show, part one, I guess you would say, of Wrestle Kingdom, which means he should end up being in a match at Wrestle Kingdom. They speculated that maybe he'll have a third match with Juice Robinson after, you know, he won the U.S. title from Juice in June. Then they had Juice beat Moxley in the G1, so they're all knotted up now. And, you know, they had a couple of good matches together. And actually, the first match was very good, and I guess that could work. And Juice is somebody who, you know, is on the ascent in New Japan, so why not have Moxley put him over on the way out? I guess that could work, but I'm still waiting on that Moxley-Suzuki match. So, just personally, I wouldn't mind seeing that. And finally, there was yet another AEW signing this week. Orange Cassidy, freshly squeezed, is now a part of the All Elite Wrestling roster. Some people seem to think that I am Orange Cassidy, but they have no proof of this. So I shall speak about him in the third person here. Orange Cassidy has signed a deal with AEW, and this has led to a lot of divided opinion. I'm sure Jim Cornette's having an aneurysm somewhere. When is he not having an aneurysm? So on one side, you have people who think that he's entertaining. On the other side, you have people who think that he is the complete opposite of what AEW ought to be, and that the company may be relying too much on comedy characters. You know, for a company that wants to be more sports oriented and have, you know, wins and losses mean things and just take a different approach than maybe something you would see in WWE, you know, is signing somebody like Orange Cassidy the way for this company to go? You have him and the Librarian and a bunch of characters that people really just don't seem to like. And I'm not the biggest fan of the Librarian stuff anyway. That's just a matter of personal taste. But you get a lot of divided opinion on this. And the thing, you know, if you're not familiar with Orange Cassidy, I'm sure most of you are by now, but if you're not, he's a guy who wrestles with sunglasses on. He got his hands are in his pockets almost at all times. He delivers these little micro kicks that make wrestling, you know, look like a sideshow to a lot of people. They don't like it. It's comedy wrestling to them. He is dubbed the laziest man in professional wrestling. That is his gimmick. And my attitude is, this company has signed a lot of very talented wrestlers so far. They've put together an impressive roster up to this point of talent, all of whom bring something different to the table. Some of them are more technical. Some of them are more high spot oriented. Some of them are more comedy. Some come from a lucha background. Some come from a Japanese background. Some were big stars somewhere else. Other names you've probably never heard of before in your entire life. What is so bad about them signing Orange Cassidy? We've seen him once in this company, in the Battle Royal at Double or Nothing. The man can wrestle. He's wrestled for over 15 years. He's been doing the Orange Cassidy stuff for about half that time. He wanted to stand out. He wanted to be different. There actually is this great little kind of mini documentary that was filmed a couple of years ago that followed him around on the independents and interviewed him, and he kind of explained this. It's up on YouTube. He wanted to stand out and be different. You know, he could do a moonsault off the top, but guess what? So can everybody else, and they can do it better than he can. So, all right, well, I guess that won't be my thing. What can I do? What can I do to have fun? What can I do to stand out from the pack and be different than what everybody else is doing? And it's worked for him. It earned him a contract. 6 months ago, I bet you didn't even know what an Orange Cassidy was. Now he's got people talking about him. They either love the guy or they hate the guy. That sounds like somebody that I would probably want to have on my roster. as a utility player. And again, the man can wrestle. I watched that Beyond Wrestling match online, the one that he had with David Starr at the end of last year. It's a very good match. So he can wrestle. I suspect that we'll get a lot of the same comedy at first, but in time, after a few months maybe, he'll start to show more and more of what he can do. Because he can't just do, you know, the hands in the pockets thing and the little mini kicks all the time. But you give the character a chance to evolve and, again, show people over time what he is capable of. Yeah, you know, and there is something to be said, I think, for him going out there and doing all that stuff and doing that shtick. And maybe people who have never seen him before look at him and think the same thing that a lot of you are thinking. Like, all right, I don't see it. I don't get it. Why is this guy on TNT? Why is this guy All Elite? I don't understand it. But then he busts out a big move here, busts out a big move there, and it's like, wow, I didn't know he could do that. Maybe that's the idea. Maybe that's the idea. I almost think like a Nick Dinsmore when they brought him in as Eugene. Yeah, Nick Dinsmore was said to have been a really good wrestler, and I didn't get to see a lot of it because I didn't see his work in OVW and pre-WWE, but I heard about what a great wrestler he is and what a great trainer he'll make one day. And then he comes in with the Eugene gimmick, and it's the polar opposite of what you would expect from somebody who is dubbed a great wrestler. But that was the character that he was given. He made the most of it. Now, if Eugene one day got bopped on the head by a frying pan, all of a sudden he came out as the modern incarnation of Bret Hart and started doing all these moves that you never saw him do before, that would have been pretty impressive. It would have been a different side of him that people had never seen before. Now, they never went in that direction. But there is something to be said for a character that is given the chance to evolve over time. I'm just saying, I think people are getting way ahead of themselves here and are just getting way too upset about something that's not worth getting upset over. You know, as long as they don't go too overboard on the comedy, I don't see any problems having somebody like him on their roster. He got over great with their audience. That's an audience of diehards. And yes, they should find a way to appeal to more than just the diehards, but you got to keep a little something for the fans that brung you to the dance. For the ones who bought up all these tickets for Vegas, and for DC, and for Boston, and for Philly. Orange Cassidy is one of those things. You don't take all of that away. You don't go to TNT and completely strip away everything that kind of brought you to this point. And he's a small part of it, and he's only been on one show so far, but he's a part of that. I think that's a small price to pay in order to keep that part of your audience happy. Or maybe I really am Orange Cassidy and you're all just a bunch of jealous haters. Well, that's just too damn bad. Deal with it. WWE isn't the only one preparing for a return to Madison Square Garden next month. AAA was all set to debut at MSG on September 15th, but slow ticket sales have changed that. It seemed very odd to begin with that they thought they would be able to fill the garden. According to a report in The Observer, they had only moved up to this point about 2,000 tickets, and tickets had been on sale for quite a while, and they were only able to move 2,000. So instead, they made the announcement this week that the show is being moved to the adjacent Hulu Theater at Madison Square Garden that same night. That building can fit a little over 5,000 people, which in that case means they're almost halfway towards capacity all of a sudden. People who already bought tickets are guaranteed a seat of equal or greater value in the new venue. So if you already bought a ticket, you should be in good shape. And if anything, you'll have probably a closer and a better view of the action. So you should be okay. This would not be the first time they have run the theater at MSG before. They did once back in 1994. It had a different name at that time. But they have run that building before. Eddie Guerrero was on that show. Art Barr, Conan, Jake the Snake Roberts were all a part of that show. On this show, Tessa Blanchard will defend her Reina de Reinas title against Taya Valkyrie. And this is just the best. Blue Demon Jr. and Dr. Wagner Jr. will wrestle in a rematch from the recent Triple Mania main event, the one where Wagner lost and then promptly announced his retirement, a retirement that he quickly rescinded 1 week later. So he's already back. It'd be like Kurt Angle, you know, my WrestleMania is going to be my last match, and he goes out there and he loses to Baron Corbin, and a week later he says, you know what, I can't stand losing to Baron Corbin, guess what, I'm back. It's like you always expect the guys to come back at some point. But this was quite the quick turnaround here, which I take it has happened before in Mexican wrestling, but just the idea of it is just hilarious to me. But now comes a report from ESPN that former UFC champion Cain Velasquez, who made his pro wrestling debut at Triple Mania and looked pretty impressive in doing so, as part of a tag team match, that he will be part of the Madison Square Garden, well, I'm sorry, the theater show at Madison Square Garden in New York as well. Although, doing what, we don't know. I assume wrestling. I have no idea if it would be a singles match, a tag team match, or what. Or maybe not wrestling. Maybe he'd be doing something else. Maybe he'll throw somebody around. Maybe he'll have an arm wrestling match. Maybe he'll have an MMA exhibition. Who knows? But it does make sense. You know, he would be an attraction that probably would help move some tickets. And, you know, they have a lot fewer tickets to worry about moving now than they did a week ago. So if you want to watch that show, it will be airing live on Fight TV. That is on September 15th, price tag of $29.99. Some other big news, not official yet, but it looks like it could be any day now. The Observer and PW Insider both reporting that NXT is likely headed to television, but not to Fox Sports 1, like we all expected and had been believed, but rather to the USA Network. And again, an announcement could be coming as early as tomorrow. Possibly by the time some of you listen to this. That per the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which has been accurate with some reports before. The belief is that NXT... So let's back up a little bit here. Because I already got comments from people on the video that I had put up last week when I took the clip from the show and put it on YouTube. Talking about NXT possibly moving to FS1 and people joking, haha, you know, Meltzer wrong again. It's not going to FS1, it's going to USA. All I'll say is this, you know, you can laugh and mock all you want to, and Dave can defend himself. He's not always right, but, you know, the details are still the same. It's not like it's some bogus report that was completely fabricated. The belief is the show is going to be 2 hours, which I believe he also reported, every Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m., which means it would be directly competing with AEW on TNT, and that the premiere date is likely to be sometime in advance of October 2nd, which is when AEW launches on TNT. So I guess they would be doing that to get the jump on AEW. There's no other explanation for why they would do that. The show would be live on at least some weeks. More likely, it would be live every week and would remain at Full Sail University. So if you are one of these people hoping that they get out of Full Sail or they move around, I guess they could always move around a few times a year, but it doesn't sound like that's the plan. Full Sail would still be their base and where they would base the show out of every single week. This would not be the first time that NXT has aired on USA. There was one episode that aired 2 years ago as part of an entire week of WWE programming. I think it was in December, probably heading into the holidays. And I looked it up how it did. It did about 840,000 overnight viewers, which was good at the time for number 22 on all of cable television. So that's the only frame of reference we have for how NXT may do on the USA Network, or on any network, really. Because we don't get those kinds of stats and numbers from the showings on the network, although NXT is supposedly consistently the highest viewed thing on the entire network. Which begs the question, what happens now? Do you maintain a separate NXT show on the WWE Network? Or are you taking away from the network one of the big draws for a lot of people? Are there going to be people who go ahead and cancel their network subscription because of this? Because not everybody is into the classic content. And I mean, someone like me, not that I have time to watch all the stuff on there that I want to, but when I hear, like I just read something about tomorrow, for example, on Monday, there's a big classic dump of content, you know, happening with the network where they're adding another 20 episodes of WCW Saturday Night from 1993. This is in addition to the episodes from 93 that they had previously uploaded. I love hearing stuff like that. Now, am I going to sit here and go through all 20 episodes of Saturday Night? Probably not. But I like the idea that I can bring up the old stuff anytime I want to and catch up with it. So I'm all about the classic stuff, but not everybody is. There are some people and newer fans who just watch the network to watch NXT and, you know, some of the original shows like Table for Three and Ride Along and, you know, the 365 documentaries, which are very well done, and the pay-per-views. And that's it. And if you take NXT away, that's reason enough for some people to say, you know what, I'm not renewing. So that'll be interesting as well. I would have to think they maintain some kind of NXT presence on the network, or maybe just keep the one-hour show and just add a two-hour show on TV. Now you get 3 hours of NXT every week. That's sort of a... It's almost like a backdoor way of getting to 3 hours of NXT. Like, we have 3 hours of Monday Night Raw, and people wonder why I think this is all just overkill and why I worry about stuff like this. But, you know, Brian Alvarez noted that he was told there was a meeting on Friday morning, I believe, with a number of NXT talents where they were specifically told that NXT, flat out, was moving to USA. PW Insider says there are those within the company who believe it's already a done deal, and it's just a matter of announcing it. The next scheduled taping, they just had a taping this week. The next taping is scheduled, I believe, for September 11th. So that could be the earliest day if they wanted to take the show live on TV that they can do so. But they said, you know, something similar in that people who work at Full Sail have been told to prepare for a longer show. And this is really the worst thing as a fan of the current format that I could hear. Because the idea of expanding the show is just something that is not at all appetizing to me. As much as I like NXT, this is not something that I find appealing at all. I think that they are treading on dangerous ground here. You know, and I get it. Oh, we want to grow NXT. This is the next logical step to grow NXT. You put it on television. You go live. I'm not against that. But the idea that it has to be expanded. I'm just not a fan of this idea. So, but, you know, and I know some of you are going to love it. Hey, great, more NXT. But more is not always better. So we have to just wait and see. I'm not going to condemn anything, you know, until I see it. I'm just voicing my concern. As far as the NXT versus AEW element is concerned, it's why this is happening now. Of course it is. You'd be a fool to think otherwise. And that's wrestling. That's wrestling. AEW, you know, they've poked the bear a few times, sometimes in good fun. Well, the bear pokes back. And it's up to them now to give people a reason to want to watch their show live and not on DVR. And make people watch NXT later, or maybe just not watch NXT at all. It really would be the closest thing, you know, that little failed Impact experiment aside from 2010... This would be the closest thing to what we had 20 years ago when people were flipping back and forth between Raw and Nitro. Now, the numbers are not going to be the same. You're not going to have 10 or 11 million people combined watching pro wrestling on a Wednesday night like you did back then at their peak. But again, this would be the closest thing to that. And who knows, maybe it spurs both parties on to do better and try some things that maybe otherwise they wouldn't try. And it's going to make the shows more exciting and the fans are the big winners in the end. But there's no doubt that, you know, if and when this happens, this is going to sting AEW, at least a little bit. If they're trying right out of the gate to pop a big number and impress TNT and kind of rope in as many fans as they possibly can, you know, and pop a big number and everything on October 2nd, and then WWE turns around and they load up that NXT show on October 2nd, and maybe October 9th and October 16th, and they put together some big matches or a big debut, or, you know, they bring in some main roster names, which I don't doubt that they would do whether AEW is around or not. If they're putting NXT on television, they're going to want to make sure it's a success. How do you do that? Well, you bring in some names from the main roster, at least the first few weeks. AEW or no AEW, I think they would be doing that anyway. It's kind of like Main Event. Remember when they brought back Main Event? I mean, Main Event used to be this one-off special that they would do. They did it in 88. They did it... I'm sorry, did they do it in 88? No, I don't think they did. They did it... Well, maybe they did. I'm not sure now. I know they did a Main Event special in 89. That was the one where the Mega Powers split. The following year in 90, they did another Main Event special. It was Hogan against the Macho King, and Buster Douglas was there. It was going to be Mike Tyson. Tyson got knocked out. He bailed, so they brought in Buster Douglas. And Buster Douglas threw a punch at the end at Randy Savage that didn't connect, and Savage was smart enough to go, hit me again, and so he punched him again. And so anyway, that aside, when they debuted this Main Event show in 2012, I'm almost positive, I think the Main Event on Main Event on that first episode might have had CM Punk against Sheamus, and this would have been when CM Punk was WWE champion. So I think those first few shows, they loaded it up in a way a little bit. They wanted people to think, oh, this new show is a big deal. It's going to have some big names on there. It wasn't but more than a few weeks before it settled into the format that you expected it to have, which is that it was a C-level show in the pecking order. And it's still around, and now you'll see people like Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins and Apollo Crews and Dana Brooke, and no offense to any of them, but they're the C-string of WWE. And that's what Main Event has become. So I'm sure they don't want NXT to become that, and NXT has a lot of names that the mainstream audience may not recognize, so yes, I would be stunned if they don't have people like an AJ Styles or a Daniel Bryan or some other main roster names on at least those first few episodes if they go to USA. Names that the USA audience would recognize. So that may work. I'm sure that's going to work against AEW, and they're going to have to just work that much harder to convince people, hey, you know, watch what we're doing. We're putting on a better show. And it could be fun for the fans. But I'll speak for myself here. I'm also spread so damn thin with all of this wrestling these days. You know, back then, for me anyway, it was Raw and Nitro. That was it. And then SmackDown eventually got introduced on UPN. But wrestling was so hot at the time, and I was younger, and it was kind of the hip thing, and wrestling was in vogue, and, you know, you wanted more wrestling back then. I would have killed as a wrestling fan back in 97, 98 to have a 24-hour wrestling channel like we have now. With WWE Network, are you kidding me? I would never have left the house. But now it's like, you know, you've got all of these different promotions and all of these different shows just from WWE alone. Forget AEW and MLW and everything else. And it's too much. But back then it was Raw and Nitro. Maybe I would check out ECW late at night on the weekend. It was on at 3 a.m. You know, if I happened to flip over from some Shannon Tweed movie on Cinemax. But that was my wrestling fix. You know, now you got to keep up with 3 hours of Raw and 2 hours of SmackDown. Now NXT, which was always an easy watch, goes to 2 hours. Then you got 2 hours of AEW. That doesn't leave time for much else. And at what point do you just get burned out by it all? So while we're talking NXT, I may as well just dive into the rest of my NXT thoughts here for the week. NXT on Wednesday was a very simple show, a two-match show, taped in Toronto prior to TakeOver. It's always funny when they throw it to Mauro Ranallo and Nigel McGuinness and Beth Phoenix at ringside, and they're, you know, in the Scotiabank Center in Toronto, and it's obvious that this was taped prior to TakeOver going on the air, but they have to talk about the main event, which they're about to show highlights of. They have to talk about it in very vague terms as though it's already taken place. I just always find that very amusing. So there were a lot of highlights on this show, but the two matches were Breezango reunited, back together again, Fandango's first match in months, against the Forgotten Sons of Anarchy, and Breezango picked up the win. So I guess they're going to keep them together as a team. The singles run for Tyler Breeze back in NXT has come to a screeching halt, which kind of makes me sad, but the people were into Breezango, so what do I know? And in the finals of the breakout tournament that has been happening now for the last several weeks, Jordan Miles beat Cameron Grimes, 450 splash off the top for the win. Good match, not quite what I expected from these two, and the crowd did not seem to know who they were at all, but a good match. And with the win, William Regal, he came out on stage to present Jordan Miles with a contract for a match for the championship of his choosing in NXT. And I think a one-off, which I would imagine what we're going to end up getting in the next few weeks, is probably a one-off on NXT television with Adam Cole defending the NXT championship against Jordan Miles. So, hey, Adam Cole and ACH 1 week on NXT, that should be fun. You know, or is Adam Cole still the champion? There was a title change at the NXT tapings on Thursday. I will not say which title. There's four of them. You can guess which one if you don't already know. I don't believe the title change is going to be airing on TV for another few weeks, so I won't spoil it. I will wait until after it airs and then talk about it. But if you do want to know, it is out there, so just FYI. And lastly here, the Evolved champion, Austin Theory, fresh off his cameo at TakeOver Toronto, is part of the latest class of recruits to the WWE Performance Center. Well, that didn't take long. Remember I talked about Austin Theory last week? He showed up on the TakeOver special. He waved. And then I said Triple H in the post-show conference audio, when he was asked about Austin Theory, said, well, we have an agreement with him, but he's in Evolve. It's not like he signed with NXT or anything. And then we come to find out that he has signed with NXT. So, although he is still the Evolve champion. So he's part of the new class along with Santana Garrett, which I was very happy to hear about. I have no idea why it took this long for them to get her. And yet, she had her tryout a while back, and Ivelisse was obviously not signed. Instead, she will be appearing at the AEW All Out show in a few weeks as part of the Casino Battle Royal for a shot at the new AEW Women's title. I don't know if they did make her an offer. I have no way of knowing if WWE did make her an offer and she turned it down, or they just didn't make her an offer at all. My sense is that they just were not interested and they did not make her an offer. Maybe they just weren't impressed by her tryout. That's what I would presume is what happened, and that there was no rejection on her part. Maybe they know something about this woman that we don't, but I just don't get it. I don't get it. I really don't. This woman is a badass. Whatever it was that, or whatever it is that they may have against her, if she signs with AEW, I think she would make a great addition to their women's division. Beginning Monday night on Raw, WWE is resurrecting the King of the Ring tournament for the first time in 4 years. The last King of the Ring was Bad News Barrett, remember him, in 2015. The last two King of the Ring winners actually ended up worse off for having won. One of them isn't even in the company anymore. Doesn't get much worse than that. The other one being Sheamus. I remember they put antlers on him for a while after that. That did, I didn't say irreparable damage, but it did great harm to Sheamus' career. And, they not only that, but if I remember, I think Sheamus a while back did a table for three, and it might have been a table for three of King of the Ring winners. And they were openly mocking his reign or his run as the king and how bad it was. It's how awful it was. You know, the thing is, like, they have to treat King of the Ring as being a big deal in order for this to work. And that remains to be seen if this is anything other than just a gimmick to drive ratings for a few weeks, which it absolutely is. But do they want it to be more than that? I don't know. I'm not convinced of that. You know, on Twitter, they refer to it as the prestigious King of the Ring tournament, and I laugh. I mean, I don't expect them to say that, you know, the shitty King of the Ring tournament, but the prestigious, they talk about it as the prestigious. Oh, yeah, so prestigious that it's the first one we've had in 4 years. And before that, I think it was 5 years. So in the last decade, we've had two kings. Yeah, very prestigious. Very prestigious. So it's a 16-man bracket that will see matches take place on Raw and SmackDown over these next few weeks, including the semifinals to be held September 9th. And September 10th at the Raw and SmackDown shows at Madison Square Garden. And then the final match would take place September 15th at the Clash of Champions pay-per-view. I used to be a big fan of the King of the Ring. I did a whole sound-off episode devoted entirely to the history of the event, including all the shows that were held in the years before they even turned it into a pay-per-view, going all the way back to 1985. That was episode 278 of the sound-off. And I think the first pay-per-view in 93 is still the best out of all of them. That's one of my all-time favorite pay-per-views, period. Bret Hart's performance that night was just fantastic. Three very different types of opponents for Bret that night. Three very different victories. None of which occurred with the Sharpshooter, interestingly enough. He beat Razor Ramon. He beat Mr. Perfect. He beat Bam Bam Bigelow with a victory roll. All different opponents, different styles, and not one Sharpshooter win among them. But Stone Cold winning the King of the Ring, you know, that changed his entire career because of the whole Austin 316 speech that came at the end. Others like Booker T and William Regal, it helped their careers. I still maintain that Regal could have had at least a short run with the world title in 2008, had he not gotten himself suspended. I'm not a fan of spreading out the matches like this. I'm more a fan of the way they did it the first 3 years. all in one night using an 8-man bracket if you don't count the qualifying matches that aired on TV. If you're of the opinion that you would like to see the King of the Ring come back as its own standalone pay-per-view, then it has to be a one-night-only tournament. Otherwise, why even bother? Why even bother? You know, they're going to do it this way, and okay, that's fine also, but I just prefer the other format better. I like the story of having to survive up to 3 different matches in one night to really earn that win, to really earn that crown. But I get it. They have many, many more hours of television to fill now than they did in 1993. Right? 93, they had, Raw was still brand new. They had Monday Night Raw, which wasn't even the flagship. The flagship, really, for them was still the syndicated shows. Now, remember, they aired some qualifying matches on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, but it built to this tournament all in one night at the pay-per-view, and that's the way that it should be. But now it's a gimmick to fill TV time, so I get it. But like I said, 16 men, 8 from Raw, 8 from SmackDown. The brackets look like this. On the Raw side, Cesaro against Samoa Joe, Ricochet against Drew McIntyre, Sami Zayn against Cedric Alexander, and The Miz against Baron Corbin. On the SmackDown side of the bracket, we've got Kevin Owens against Elias, Buddy Murphy against Mustafa Ali, Chad Gable against Shelton Benjamin, and Apollo Crews against Andrade Cien Almas. And we know that on Raw tomorrow night, we are getting Cesaro and Joe, and Cedric against Sami. And on Tuesday, we're going to get Owens and Elias, and Apollo against Andrade. Chad Gable, by the way, just mentioned his name. Let me just get this out of the way here. Chad Gable may be getting a new name soon, although I'm not ready to freak out about it just yet, because it may turn out to not be for him after all. That is not confirmed. But I'm sure some of you have seen these reports of a new name being, I guess, trademarked by WWE. The name Shorty G. And there have been rumors that it could be a new name for Liv Morgan, possibly, who has not been seen on TV since losing to Charlotte Flair many, many weeks ago, and she teased a new direction for her character, and then we never heard from her again. So I guess the belief is that the Shorty G could be, you know, the G could be for the G in Morgan, which is a bit of a stretch, but okay. And it wouldn't be a killer for her the way that it would be for somebody like Gable if they were to give it to him. And what worries me is that there was a segment that they put up on their YouTube channel from SmackDown on Tuesday. I don't believe this aired on TV. At least I don't remember it airing on TV. Shelton Benjamin's in the back. He's being asked a question. And then the camera pans over and we see Gable just standing there. And he goes, "Hey, what's up, Shelton?" And Shelton just looks at him with this almost disgusted look on his face. And he says, "Shorty." And he walks off. Shorty. Shorty G. If they give him this fucking name, I hope he starts counting down the days to the end of his contract and his feet carry him out of that fucking company as fast as they can. I would say that it would kill his career, but we already, you know, WWE already did that. I'm not sure they could do much worse in terms of trying to kill whatever potential career this guy could have had and could still have. I'll say this. If we end up with King Corbin in this tournament, and I don't think we will. I don't think we will. It could happen, but I don't think it will. But if they were going to do that, I would love to see Gable go all the way to the finals and have them rehash the finish that those two did in their Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic match. This was years ago. It might have been on that NXT Respect, the TakeOver Respect show, whatever year that was from. And this great finish in that match. This great end of days finish. Corbin pinned Gable. But just the way they did it was awesome. And even before that, Gable hit the Chaos Theory on Corbin. So the sight of Gable, who is smaller, hitting a move like that on Corbin, it was just very impressive. That could have been a big breakout performance for Gable and American Alpha. But I think enough people did not see it where to rehash it would not be the worst thing in the world. And of course, Corbin would win. That is if the idea is that Corbin goes on to win the entire thing. I know this is not going to happen. Gable is not going to go that far. I don't expect him to go that far, but that's if Corbin has to win, I would love to see them do that. But this company has been sleeping on Gable for so long. Now, a pair of really good matches on 205 Live with Jack Gallagher is not a measure of how good this guy is. And nobody has had a chance to see it. And that needs to change. And giving this guy Shorty G as a name is a career killer. Some people will say, well, this may open up a whole new, you know, window for him in terms of his personality. You know, it could turn out to be a great thing for his career. The guy has personality. I saw his personality on display with the, you know, the backstage vignettes and interviews and stuff with Jason Jordan. We really not had a chance to see that. You know, he did the whole thing with Bobby Roode. It was Roode and Gable, Glorious Gable, whatever the hell the team name was. So he had a chance to show some of his personality there. But even then, not really. Not really. He's the kind of guy who I could see, and I know there's been a lot of comparisons made to him and Kurt Angle. And Angle is aware of it, and Gable is aware of it, and there's a reason for it. Because there's a lot of similarities between them. But one of the things they did with Angle was so good. His comedic timing was incredible. So they would do these funny segments with him. It was kind of self-deprecating humor. He was making an ass out of himself. But he was very entertaining, and he could always back it up in the ring, because he was a legit athlete. But he would be going on college campuses, you know, to campaign for abstinence and handing out condoms to the students. And all these things that I remember him doing back then in the year 2000 when he really, you know, broke out as a heel. And I always looked at Gable and I said, he's the kind of guy who could be doing, maybe not giving out condoms to people, but he's the kind of guy who could be doing stuff like that. He's got a sense of humor about him. He can be that funny guy who's on the smaller side, even smaller than Angle was. But when he gets in the ring, he's like a little bulldog, right? I remember when AJ Styles came to WWE, what was Vince McMahon's name for him? You're calling him like a bulldog or he was calling him some kind of a, oh God, I don't know if it was a bulldog or some kind of dog. You know, like he's a smaller guy, but he's like a pit bull or something like that. But that's what Gable could be. And I hear these reports, Shorty G might be good for some limited comedy, but it would also kill his fucking career. And if that is the best that you can come up with for somebody like Chad Gable, then you don't deserve Chad Gable. But I also look at these brackets, and I see the world is going to get to see what Ali and Murphy can do together in the ring. I just talked about this with Wade Keller on Tuesday. We were talking, well, what's next for Buddy Murphy when this whole storyline with, you know, Roman and everything is kind of run its course? And I brought up Ali as a possibility for, you know, like a program, remembering those great matches that the two of them had on 205 Live. And now I see all of a sudden, boom, they're matched up in the King of the Ring. And I just hope that they can give them at least 10 minutes in that first round to go out there and just show people what they can do and try to tear the house down. I see that as being the kind of match that maybe initially the crowd is kind of lukewarm to, very quiet, and then it builds. And by the end, they've got people just in the palm of their hand. They can do that. They can pull off a match like that. So here's my prediction. Everybody's filling out their brackets like it's March Madness and making predictions. So here's mine. Kind of an odd match in the first round of heel versus heel with Samoa Joe against Cesaro tomorrow night. I think those two eliminate each other. Either a brawl into a double countout or maybe a time limit expiration. You know, boy, it sure would be nice for them to go old school and announce time limits for these matches. Boy, wouldn't it? It's been a while since we've seen that. I remember it used to be 15 minutes for the first round, 30 minutes for the semifinals, and an hour for the final. That was before they expanded it to the 16-man bracket. However they do it, both guys, I think, are gone, which means that the winner of the Drew McIntyre-Ricochet match gets a bye into the semifinal round. I think that's going to be Drew McIntyre, with Ricochet more likely to wrestle AJ again, possibly for the U.S. title at Clash of Champions. I think Cedric Alexander beats Sami Zayn tomorrow night, and I think Baron Corbin beats The Miz, giving us Cedric and Corbin in the quarterfinals. Cedric pulls out the win, the miracle win, and we get a rematch in the semis between Alexander and McIntyre. McIntyre wins again, goes on to the finals. Now, on the other side of the bracket, it's easy to think, well, Shane McMahon's just going to screw Kevin Owens this Tuesday in the opening round, and Elias is going to advance. Well, that's what they want you to think. But as over And as popular as Kevin Owens is right now on that SmackDown brand, and he is, for all intents and purposes, I look at that SmackDown brand, and you know, he looks to be the top babyface. He's, or at least right up there with Kofi. It's KO. So as over as he is right now, that would be incredibly stupid to bounce him. I mean, why bounce him? You want to keep people watching this tournament each week. You're spreading these matches out. You're not doing the tournament in one night like it used to be done. You're spreading the matches out. You want to, you know, give people a reason who are fans of this guy to keep watching TV each week. Why bounce him so early from the tournament? So I think Owens advances over Elias. They try to screw him, but he outsmarts them, which I know is something very uncommon for babyfaces these days in WWE. All the dumb babyfaces out there. But he outsmarts them, he wins, and he moves on. Buddy Murphy advances over Ali. Gable advances over Shelton Benjamin. And Andrade advances over Apollo. So that brings us to the next round, the quarterfinals. Kevin Owens beats Buddy Murphy. And Andrade beats Gable. And what a frickin' match that would be. Chad Gable and Andrade. So we end up with Kevin Owens against Andrade in the semifinal round. Owens wins. And we get Owens and McIntyre in the finals at Clash of Champions. And that's where Shane screws over Kevin Owens. The screw job is coming. It's just a matter of when. I think you save it for the finals. Which gives us King McIntyre. Drew McIntyre will be the King of the Ring for 2019. And history is on my side in terms of the number of babyface kings and the number of heel kings. The vast majority of the... I mean, think about this. The vast majority of the kings that we have seen over the years that win the tournament or have this gimmick are heels. Being the king is inherently a heel gimmick. You know, you can go all the way back to when Harley Race was the king, and the Macho King, and King Haku. And then even once it became a pay-per-view in 93, 11 of the 14 kings, King of the Ring winners, since 1993 have been heels at the time that they won the crown. So it's not a guarantee that a heel is always going to win, but if you're betting, then yeah, it's probably... a good choice to put your money down on a heel here in this tournament. One of the many reasons why I am going with Drew McIntyre as my pick. I actually like the idea that it's kind of unpredictable. You know, you have people who are convinced that, oh, it's going to be Corbin. Of course it is. It's going to be King Corbin. You've got people who think it's going to be McIntyre. You have people who think it's going to be Kevin Owens. You have people who think it's going to be Andrade. There are a lot of possibilities here in this tournament. And I like that. Some people think it's going to be Ricochet. But I like the fact that you really can't say for sure who's going to win this tournament. You have a few different good options here. I think that's great. But I do think that it comes down to KO and Drew, and Shane screws KO. And we end up with Kevin Owens getting Shane McMahon one more time. This time inside Hell in a Cell in October to hopefully, finally, end this feud once and for all. Shane can take his crazy cell bump, and he can disappear. You know, I see people saying, well, Kevin Owens, he needs to win. Like Stone Cold did. This could be for him what it was for Stone Cold. You know, what it was for Austin in 96. And I hear that, and I say, how long have you been watching wrestling for? When I hear people say that. How long have you been watching wrestling for? Were you even watching when Austin won in 96? I don't think you were. I don't see it that way at all. Austin had nothing when he won that tournament in 1996. Nothing. He wasn't even supposed to win the tournament. Triple H was going to win the tournament. Triple H has said he was going to win the tournament. And then the curtain call happened, and he got screwed, he got punished, he won it the following year. But they gave it to Austin instead. He was the backup. He was the backup quarterback that they put in the game that year at the King of the Ring. And even then, after he won, yes, he had the Austin 316 speech, but even after he won, people think winning that tournament just launched him into being a big star. No, it did not. he was wrestling Yokozuna on the pre-show at SummerSlam 2 months later. It wasn't until Bret Hart decided he was coming back, he was re-signing with WWE and not going to WCW and taking the offer that I believe he had to go to WCW. And they started to build to a match between Austin and Bret that year at the Survivor Series. It wasn't until that feud with Bret Hart that people finally started to take notice of how good Austin was. Austin 316 helped, especially in terms of merch. You know, but it wasn't as though he just won the tournament and all of a sudden he was launched into the stratosphere. People think that tournament is what launched him. It wasn't. I look at this more like the Deadly Game tournament in 98 at Survivor Series, where Austin got screwed over, ironically, by Shane McMahon. I feel like we're always in this weird, like, vortex where, you know, some of the faces change and some things change, but the more they change, the more they really stay the same. Here we are again. I believe Shane McMahon is on the cusp once again of screwing over the top babyface here in this tournament. So he screwed over Austin. You know, Shane went heel, screwed over Stone Cold, and Austin chased The Rock all the way to WrestleMania for the championship. This is after he got screwed again the next night on TV by The Undertaker and a shovel shot to the face. But that, I think, would be the better comparison to make here. Owens is already over. He is already a star to the current audience. He's not a star like Austin was. Nobody on this roster is. But the people are already behind him. You know, he's already been around here in this company for about 5 years or so. He's already got equity. Austin had no equity. Austin was the ringmaster. You know, leading up to the King of the Ring, he had only been Stone Cold for maybe 2 months. I don't even know if it was that long. Maybe a month. You know, meanwhile, you've got Drew McIntyre. McIntyre is being advertised, at least locally here he is, for matches coming up against Seth Rollins. Although none of them are listed as being for the Universal Championship. I don't know what the title match is going to be, a Clash of Champions. I assume it probably will end up being Seth Rollins and Braun Strowman based on, you know, what they did on Monday. If so, I don't see Rollins dropping the title so soon after getting it back, which I think would be terrible for Braun, because that means he falls short yet again. But then McIntyre becoming King of the Ring should earn him a shot at the championship. There should be something at stake here. A shot at their, you know, respective brand's top title. If winning a briefcase earns you a championship match, and winning a breakout tournament in NXT earns you a match for the title of your choosing, there is no reason that your Royal Majesty should not be gifted a championship match as well. Everything should revolve around the title. I'm a big believer in that. I always have been. It hasn't always been that way. But I believe everything should revolve around the championship, or in this case, two championships. That should be the reason for your very existence in this company. Those titles should be the most important thing in the world. So I think we're getting King McIntyre. May he have better luck with the crown than Sheamus and Wade Barrett did. But that's who I think is winning. Now, who do I want to see win? If I had the power to decide, who do I want to see win King of the Ring? I would love to see Andrade win. I'd have it go down to Andrade and Ricochet in the finals. And Andrade wins, and you've got Zelina now as his queen. I mean, he just so happens to be dating Charlotte at the moment, who does call herself the queen on TV. But I think King Andrade with Queen Zelina could work for him the way it did for Booker and Charmel. I mean, hey, it got Booker a world title. Monday Night Raw was live from Toronto, Ontario, Canada Monday night. 3,400 plus votes in our Twitter poll at Solomonster. 39% thumbs up, 13% thumbs down, 48% did not watch. So pretty good percentage there in terms of the thumbs up this week. I'm just going to focus on the key items here. I'm not reviewing this entire show because I just don't have the strength. All that really matters anyway is that Sasha Banks is back. She is a heel, and she is feuding with Becky Lynch. The wrestling gods have granted my wish. After 4 months away, the last we saw of her, she and Bayley dropped their women's tag team titles at WrestleMania to the Iconics in that four-way. Sasha Banks then came out on Monday night, and she interrupted a Natalya promo Natalia was out there with her arm in a sling from her match with Becky the night before. She claimed a dislocated elbow that she was going to have an MRI on. And as she was talking about the anniversary of her father's death, because it had been a year since Jim the Anvil Neidhart passed away, and she was kind of getting emotional, all of a sudden Sasha Banks' music plays. And Michael Cole could not contain his excitement. Oh my, could it be? It is! It's boss time! All this immediately after Natty just mentioned her father's death, by the way. But who cares, says Michael Cole. It's boss time. You know he's been holding that in for 4 months. I'm surprised that he wasn't like a wind-up doll saying it over and over and over again. Sasha gets in the ring. She embraces Natty. She points at the sky, and you can see her mouthing to Natty how proud he would be, how proud your father would be of you. And she turns to go grab a microphone, and we see Natty, and all of a sudden we see Sasha come back into frame, and she just clobbers Natty right in the face. And then she rips off her purple wig to reveal blue hair. Maybe that means she's going to SmackDown, I don't know. She beat the crap out of Natty some more, threw her out of the ring and into the ring steps, threw her back into the ring, and was about to take a steel chair to her when Becky Lynch's music hit. Becky runs down to the ring to make the save. We have a brawl to go at it. She knocks Sasha out of the ring. Sasha, though, grabs a chair, and she waffles Becky with the chair repeatedly, over and over and over again, relentless with the chair. And then with Becky on the ground and clearly not expecting it, Sasha reaches down, she kind of grabs her by the hair, pulls her up, says something to her, and slaps her right in the side of the face. And you could tell Becky did not appreciate that very much. She started kicking Sasha away. She looked pissed. Corey Graves was going off on Sasha Banks here from the moment that her music hit, because his whole gimmick is that he doesn't like her. Never has. And so when she turned on Natty, and Cole is freaking out at Renee Young, oh my god, and she's freaking out, you hear Graves in the background, I told you so. what did he say? He said, what a surprise. What a surprise, he said. Sasha Banks is the worst, said Corey Graves. And he proceeded to argue with Michael Cole about this. But this was awesome. This segment was awesome. It was kind of random the way that they turned her. You know, hopefully we'll get an explanation this week from her on TV. But first of all, it's good to have Sasha Banks back on TV. She's been sorely missed. This women's division, both on Raw and on SmackDown, has been dying a death for months now. With Ronda gone and Sasha gone, and they had a whole bunch of injuries. Not that I think Nia Jax would have turned the division around, but Nia's hurt, Ruby Riott is hurt. It's been a tough go where the women have been concerned. Second of all, I've missed the boss from NXT. Not from Raw, from NXT. Heel Sasha Banks has been long overdue. She's always carried herself like a heel. It's the right role for her to be in. And in the absence of Ronda Rousey, the only opponent for Becky Lynch that is even remotely interesting to me, because it has not been done since the NXT days, they had one takeover match, is Sasha Banks. Sasha Banks against Becky Lynch. So I thought this was great. It was the highlight of the show. And this should give Becky a good foil to play off of for the foreseeable future. And really, for the first time since the build with Ronda and Charlotte, I guess, heading into WrestleMania. We had Andrade Cien Almas beating Rey Mysterio in two straight falls in a 2 out of 3 falls match that combined went all of 5 or 6 minutes. But those 5 or 6 minutes were really good. For the time that it lasted, these two have had much better matches. We've seen them have much better matches on SmackDown in recent months. But they're telling some kind of a story with Rey where he's doubting himself. You know, backstage he said, oh, I've never lost 2 falls in a row like that. And he talked about, I have to be able to provide for my family. I do hate this idea that somebody like Rey Mysterio, who is a legend and who is truly one of the biggest names in all of wrestling, we're supposed to believe that if he can't perform, if he can't win matches, that his family is, I guess, going to end up out on the street. The streets of San Diego. I hear they have a big homeless problem out there in California. Like, legitimately, it's really... I mean, we have one in New York, too, that's really bad. But in California, apparently, in parts of California, it's out of control. I would hate to think that Ray and his family would find themselves in that same situation. Because he can't win a match on TV. It's like when Shawn Michaels had to be JBL's slave. Because he made some bad investments. So stupid. I guess he made some bad real estate investments. Tried to open a church and it just didn't work out. So he had to become a slave for JBL. Some stories are just so preposterous and insulting that you just cannot buy into them. Right now, this is one of those. This is starting down the path of being one of those stories for me. But it's still in the early stage. We'll see where they go with this, and if they can turn this into a way for them to... Maybe the idea is to reintroduce his son. Maybe they're going to reintroduce Dominic to television. It looked like they were building to something with Dominic and Samoa Joe. When Ray got hurt, he hurt his shoulder and he ended up being out for a month. And we haven't seen Dominic since, I don't think. But since his return from injury, Ray has been on a horrible losing streak. He was squashed in a minute by Bobby Lashley on Raw many, many weeks ago. He suffered other losses. This week he loses two straight falls to Andrade. I think he lost to McIntyre in there somewhere as well. I think Ray still has value left. He has shown that he can still hang with the younger guys. His knees have been okay. We haven't heard about any knee problems that he's had. The shoulder thing was a freak injury. Otherwise, he's stayed pretty much healthy. He's looked like he's turned back the hands of time. There is still value in Rey Mysterio, and he keeps losing. And I'm not sure how much value, if that continues, that he will have left. So I trust and I hope that there is a payoff to all of this. But I shall treat Ray far better than WWE is right now when I start my countdown of the top 8 Rey Mysterio matches later on in the podcast today. I promise you that. We got a rare segment with Stone Cold Steve Austin that was not awesome. They hooked him up via Skype to help put over Seth Rollins and his performance against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, and it all just felt so forced. Plus, his connection was not the greatest. I mean, Skype sucks, we all know that, but his connection was not the greatest. How is it, though, that... See, when I use Skype, I don't do interviews all the time, but when I do interviews, Skype is a big part of that. I use Skype, it was one of the programs I use, and I've done interviews with wrestlers. Now, I mean, on occasion, they may have a phone connection that isn't the greatest. That's on their end, that's not me. But when I use Skype and I do interviews and stuff, how is it that my shit sounds better than WWE when they hooked up Stone Cold Steve Austin? It shouldn't be that way. This is WWE. How does my shit sound better than theirs? So then they plugged the premiere of his new show, Straight Up Steve Austin, that comes on immediately after Monday Night Raw. I watched the first episode with Rob Riggle, and I enjoyed it. I'll be watching episode 2 coming up this week. I know he has one with Becky Lynch coming up later this season as well. The other awesome thing on this show, two awesome things on Monday Night Raw. After the Sasha turn and the Becky brawl came the match between Drew McIntyre and Cedric Alexander. So satisfying to see Cedric finally getting a chance to break out and mix it up with the big boys on the main roster. You know, I'm not a fan of the 205 live weight limit stuff, putting people in a box and not being able to be matched up with other main roster stars. I think men like Murphy and Ali, and now Cedric breaking out on Raw and on SmackDown should be evidence enough that, you know, one way to add variety to these shows is to match up guys like McIntyre and Joe and Rollins with, you know, I won't even say smaller guys because that implies they're all tiny and short like Rey Mysterio, and that's just not the case. I mean, I look at a guy like a Buddy Murphy, and I never think, boy, he's small. I never think that. Murphy looks good, you know, his gear aside. He looks like he could hang with anybody on that roster. Same with Cedric. You know, he doesn't look that small. I don't look at him and go, wow, what a midget. Like, I never look at Cedric Alexander and think that. Maybe standing next to somebody like a Drew McIntyre, since Drew is like 6'5", you might notice it a little bit more. But they meshed well, and they had a really fun match. Drew caught Cedric on a suicide dive and suplexed him on the floor, right on his lower back, right on the edge of the ramp. That looks like it sucked. Or it looked like it sucked. Inside, he set up for a Claymore kick. Cedric, though, was playing dead. He wouldn't get up. Like Bret Hart, he was playing dead. Like Bret did with Diesel at the Survivor Series in 95 when Diesel tried to set him up for the jackknife, and Brett just fell down and collapsed on the mat. And then he rolled up Diesel, and Diesel dropped an F-bomb, but that's a different story. So anyway, he got a small package on McIntyre for a near fall. Cedric hit a Spanish fly on McIntyre for another near fall. That was ridiculous. In the end, Drew turned him inside out with a Claymore kick, maybe the best Claymore sell that I have ever seen. And McIntyre looked like somebody who had just been in the fight of his life when this match was over. He didn't, you know, kind of blow Cedric away or blow him off like he was some kind of chump. Cedric gained something even in defeat here in this match. So it's not like, not unlike Undertaker endorsing Jeff Hardy after he beat him in that ladder match on Raw back in 2002. Would have been very easy for The Undertaker to do that, but he didn't. He showed respect. I think he actually helped Jeff to his feet. He may have shaken his hand. Like, it was, you know, Undertaker, he was a heel. He was about to go babyface, but he was a heel at the time, and he did that. Little things like that, even in defeat, go a long way. Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross retain their women's tag team titles over Asuka and Kairi Sane. No Paige. They had a taped promo from her because she was having neck surgery that, by all accounts, was a success, so good for her. Although success is not a word that we can use, unfortunately, or associate with Asuka or Kairi Sane at the moment. And that sucks. That sucks. But at least we got another tag team title defense. Maybe we'll get more than one a month from now on. Main event was Seth Rollins against AJ Styles. Anderson and Gallows interfered for the DQ. Ricochet made the save, and he too gets beaten down. That brings out Braun Strowman to save the day and give Styles two power slams. Braun grabs the tomato title from ringside, hands it over to Seth Rollins, and kind of a little tease. Maybe, you know, he might be next in line for a shot at the championship. Unless he's winning it, and I don't think he is, I think it would be awful for him to get another shot at that title and fall short yet again. So I'm not sure what their plans are. We'll get a better sense tomorrow night. I would think, maybe even as early as tomorrow night, that we end up getting a six-man tag with the OC against Seth Rollins, Ricochet, and Braun Strowman. And something maybe goes wrong, the babyfaces lose, and that could be the catalyst to build to Rollins and Strowman. But if you watch the Sasha Banks angle and the match with Drew and Cedric, this was a fantastic show, if the show was 15 minutes long. Before we get to SmackDown, support for this week's podcast comes from Manscaped, as seen on Shark Tank, number one in men's below-the-belt grooming. They offer precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. You know, you've been there before, I'm sure. Getting ready for that big date, wanting to impress your lady. You're doing your hair up all nice, collar popped on your favorite polo, which is a very douchey thing to do. Please don't do that. But before you do all of that, you want to clear some brush, like any good cowboy. Make sure you're using the right tools for the job. Don't be like that guy. He wasn't using Manscaped's Lawnmower 2.0 trimmer with skin-safe technology to prevent any nicks and cuts to his little monsters. Powered by a simple USB charge, and it's quiet, so if you live with roommates, they don't even have to know what you're doing in there. They also offer the Crop Preserver, a deodorant and moisturizer for your parts unknown. Get 20% off and free shipping when you place your order on manscaped.com with the promo code SOLOMONSTER. Make sure you've got the right tools in your toolbox. You wouldn't use sandpaper to paint your walls. Don't use some old blade on your balls. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SOLOMONSTER at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the code SOLOMONSTER and keep your little monsters happy. SmackDown Live, you know what I just said, by the way, is true. Don't pop the collar on your polo because you're a douchebag if you do that. SmackDown Live from Toronto, Canada. Twitter poll, over 2,200 votes. 40% of you voted thumbs up. Only 7% voted thumbs down. 53% did not watch. So more people did not watch than Monday Night Raw. But that's a pretty damn good up and down percentage there for SmackDown. Kevin Owens just cannot quit Shane McMahon. Or is it the other way around? Shane McMahon can't quit Kevin Owens. I don't know. His promo, Owens, that is, was interrupted by Shane McMahon. Just when you thought it might be over, should have known better based on what happened at SummerSlam with Owens using a low blow. You knew there was going to be some kind of loophole here for Shane to make this guy's life a living hell. So he came out, called this guy a cheater for what happened at SummerSlam. Because, again, as soon as Owens low blowed him in that match, I knew exactly where this was headed. And he said that he was putting Owens in a match tonight. Did not tell him against who, only that Elias was going to be the guest enforcer. And he fined Kevin Owens $100,000. Which is not as bad as Sheamus being fined $500,000 for hitting a referee many years ago. They tend to get out of control with these ridiculous fines. Owens wigged out. He said, I got a family to support. That money is for my kids' college tuition. Last I checked, Kevin Owens has two kids. He's got a son and he's got a daughter. I got news for you, KO. Although he lives in Canada. Maybe it's different in Canada. It's probably better up there. But I got news for you. $100,000 ain't going to cut it for your college tuition. That may not cut it for one kid, let alone both. You're going to have to work the double shit. You're going to have to do double shots for the rest of your career to pay off their college tuition. KO's opponent later on ended up being Samoa Joe, with Elias serving as the special enforcer. Owens had the match won when Elias pulled the referee out of the ring. Distracted was KO, who was then rolled up by Joe. Joe wins. Shane screws Kevin Owens yet again. I think this leads to Owens going all the way to the King of the Ring finals. I certainly hope he can outsmart Shane enough to at least get that far. And ultimately, he will be defeated by Drew McIntyre, and we get the blow-off between Owens and Shane at Hell in a Cell. But I am tired of this shit. Boy, am I tired of this Shane McMahon, Kevin Owens shit. Charlotte beat Ember Moon. Yet another loss for Ember. It would be harder to think back to the last time she actually won a match. I can't. I'm sure one of you will tell me, but off the top of my head, I don't remember the last time that she won a match on TV. But the match here with Charlotte was good. You know, figure eight for the submission. Charlotte gets the win. It looks like Charlotte is probably next in line for a championship match against Bayley. Meanwhile, where does Ember go from here? Where does she go? It's the plight of Ember Moon. What now? I had suggested, you know, in my predictions heading into SummerSlam, I had suggested a heel turn. She loses and then turn and then snaps after all the losing and turns heel. She did lose, but no turn. I'm not sure what else you do with her right now. She is in need of a reset. Then you have Liv Morgan, somebody like her, who teased a reset several weeks ago and has not been seen since. Hey, maybe Ember can lose to her too. Daniel Bryan came out with Rowan to defend himself and both of them from accusations that they had something to do with someone trying to murder Roman Reigns with a forklift and a car. And he said, tonight they will prove that they had nothing to do with any of this. I can't wait until next week when somebody flies a drone over Roman's head and tries to drop some kind of chemical onto him. They've got to come up with creative ways to try to kill Roman Reigns here on the show. Speaking of which, Roman Reigns wrestled Buddy Murphy. This was a very good match between these two. This was the highlight of the night, much like Drew and Cedric was the highlight of, well, Sasha, the Sasha angle was really the highlight of that show. But in terms of matches, it was Drew and Cedric on Monday. And on Tuesday, it was Roman and Buddy. Ugh, that name has just... See, this is just a great example. A name is very important. So when they conceive of these names, they really have to think ahead and think, okay, how far do we expect this person to go? Because this is going to be a name that they're saddled with for the rest of their careers. And I will say that if there was ever a wrestler on the main roster who could benefit from Vince McMahon chopping off his first name, it's Buddy Murphy. So here's to, I don't have a drink in my hand, but if I had my orange juice before with all my vitamin C, I'd be holding it up right now saying, here's to Buddy Murphy eventually becoming Murphy. I think that would be a big help to him. But they had a very good match. There was a spot where Murphy did a huge dive out onto Roman on the floor, took him out, followed by a huge meteora onto Roman from the top rope into the ring. That was good for a near fall. We had a brainbuster to Roman Reigns, another kick out for the finish. Reigns turned him inside out with a spear and then gave Murphy a nod of approval when the match was over. If all of this sounds familiar, it was a carbon copy of what we saw with McIntyre and Cedric on Monday Night Raw. Turned him inside out with a claymore in that match for the finish. Put him over at the finish. Just, you know, his demeanor and everything. Looking like he had just been to hell and back. Tonight, Buddy Murphy was playing the role of Cedric Alexander. This was the let's get the 205 Live guys over week. And it worked. Murphy, this was a star-making performance for Buddy Murphy. And Roman Reigns gave him a lot. He let him get his shit in and shine here in this match, and he really did. He gave him a lot. Both men deserve credit for putting on a hell of a match. It goes both ways. It's not just the Buddy Murphy show. It was Buddy Murphy and Roman Reigns. I saw some people, this was all Buddy. You know, Roman can't wrestle. This was all Buddy. Buddy carried him. These people just, they're so consumed with hate for this man. I remember a time when people did the same thing with John Cena. It's all Shawn Michaels' credit, you know, because he'd go out there and have a great match with Shawn Michaels. He'd go out there and have a great match with CM Punk. He'd go out there and have a great match with Daniel Bryan. He'd go out there and have a great match with Umaga. He'd go out there and have a great match with Chris Jericho. He'd go out there and have a great match with whoever. It was never John Cena's responsibility. It was always the other person who, that was the reason why the match was so good. I can't tell you how many times I read that and how many times I heard that. When Cena was, you know, still, you know, the top guy. Now you have a lot of people who reflect back and they kind of miss John Cena and they acknowledge that John Cena had a lot of great matches and it wasn't always with, you know, like a high caliber of opponent like a Kurt Angle or a Shawn Michaels. Like I said, he went in there. I mean, Umaga was very good, but he was no Shawn Michaels and Cena had a great match with him and a lot of different people over the years. A lot of different people. And I, even then, would give John Cena credit. I would have to defend him. And people would say, oh, you're kissing Cena's ass. Which, again, if you listen to those older shows, you would laugh at that. But that's just how people react. I think people will eventually come to look back at Roman Reigns in a similar way, where they give him more credit after the fact than they're willing to give him now. Because he isn't the flashiest guy in the world. And he's got his, you know, moves of doom, just like everybody does. Bret Hart had his five or six moves of doom. Cena had his moves of doom. Triple H has his moves of doom. But the fact is that Roman has had a lot of quality pay-per-view matches with people who of varying, you know, backgrounds and varying persuasions. So you got to give both guys credit. It doesn't just go one way. They both had a very good match here on the show. Although Roman did make me want to bang my head against the wall. I have to take him to task for this. On Twitter, he was responding to a fan who was praising his ability to have a five-star match on any night. And that's certainly a subjective thing. But in so doing in terms of responding to this fan, Roman referred to himself as, quote, the best performance fighter alive, end quote. This is not a debate about whether or not that's accurate or not. That's not why I'm singling him out here. The best performance fighter alive. Per what? Excuse me? Come again? Performance fighter? Holy shit! Is everybody not named Dolph Ziggler and that company afraid to just call themselves professional wrestlers? Are they really, like, do they have an allergic reaction if they refer to themselves as a professional wrestler? Does their throat close up? Does their eyeballs pop out of their head? Do their eyes swell shut? They have to have an EpiPen stuck in their leg? I mean, I don't understand this. I thought sports entertainers was cringy enough. Now they're performance fighters. Soon we're going to be calling them simulated combat soldiers. That's going to be the next phrase that we use to describe these men. I wonder if there is any other industry in the world where people willingly sign up. It is their dream job even. But they're afraid to actually admit what they do. Porn. That's the closest thing I could think of. Porn. I'm sure there's at least some porn stars that are afraid to admit to people what it is that they do for a living. Maybe friends, family. I just hope this isn't some sort of Fox thing where they're going to be calling these guys performance fighters. I mean, they're one step away from calling them play fighters. Performance fighter. Now I've heard it all. I have truly heard it all. I mean, it's, yeah, the sports entertainment thing is one thing, and then you have all this vernacular on television. It's not a hospital, it's a local medical facility, and all this stupid shit. Performance fighters. Holy shit. Oh, God. Murphy on Twitter, he issued a challenge to Daniel Bryan, which has since been accepted, and so on SmackDown this week, it will be Buddy Murphy, one-on-one against Daniel Bryan. And, you know, between this, the match last week with Roman, the match with Ali that he has coming up in the King of the Ring, this is the string of matches that really has the potential to cement this man on the main roster after all these months of stagnation. This could be the string of matches here that puts this guy on the map. Unfortunately for Murphy, he was beaten to a pulp backstage by Rowan when Daniel Bryan and Rowan showed up and they cleared the locker room. They said, everybody out, not you, you stay. And they wanted him to admit that he lied. And he did not really see Rowan backstage when Roman was nearly killed by that forklift. And Murphy refused and they beat him up for it until finally he relented and he said he lied. The old forced confession. I don't look at something like this as a burial, like some people do. I look at it as Murphy is actually involved in a top storyline on television. 3 weeks ago, he was sitting on his ass in catering. Most people watching this show could not have picked this guy out of a lineup. And as far as him not fighting back, this was right after the match with Roman. So I can excuse that. He was exhausted. He got ripped in half by a spear. He wasn't really in a position to fight back. And it's led to a match now that we're going to get on TV this week with Bryan and Murphy. So that's 2 weeks in a row that Buddy Murphy is in the feature match on SmackDown Live. As DDP would say, that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. Randy Orton and The Revival beat The New Day, Shatter Machine to Xavier Woods. After the match, Orton hit each member of New Day with an RKO. He saved two of them for Kofi Kingston. And they left us with another cliffhanger at the very end, with Daniel Bryan promising Roman Reigns to deliver the real culprit to him next week. Lots of different ways they can go with this. They can call up somebody new from NXT if they wanted to. Or they could give Luke Harper something to do instead of sitting on his ass at home. And we find out that it was Harper who was behind the wheel of that forklift and the car. Or maybe Rowan was behind the forklift and it was Harper who was driving the car. All at the behest of Daniel Bryan. So Harper now gets linked up with them. Bryan's got his own little faction going on here. Or they could just make it very obvious, and Daniel Bryan ends up admitting that we did our investigation, and guess what? And then Rowan hits Roman from behind. Rowan hits Roman, say that 10 times fast. And Bryan admits that, yeah, I did it. Or we did it. That would be very, very basic, but I suppose they could do that as well. All roads, though, we know are going to lead to Roman Reigns against Daniel Bryan. Very likely at the Clash of Champions, a match that I don't believe we've seen since Roman beat him in the main event of the Fastlane pay-per-view back in 2015. Conspicuous by his absence from Raw at SmackDown this week was The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, who we saw at SummerSlam in action for the first time. We have not seen him since. And I'm okay with that. I know some people were very upset. They think, strike while the iron is hot. What a missed opportunity to not put him on television, at least on one of the two shows, if not both shows. I don't see it that way. I look at it like The Fiend has to be saved for special occasions. Or just has to be saved for when you actually have a good idea for him. He's not the kind of guy that needs to be on television wrestling a squash match. So it sounds like they've given him a lot of leeway and a lot of creative influence and control over this character and different elements of the character, and I think that's great. And I think he's knocked it out of the park so far, and I look forward to seeing what they have in store for us in the future. But I don't need to see The Fiend on TV every week. I mean, I love the character, but I would think even I, after a few weeks of seeing the same thing over and over again, might say, all right, it's losing a little bit of its appeal. There is something to be said for Brock Lesnar, who should show up more often, but he doesn't. And so, by virtue of him never being around, there is a certain specialness to him when he does show up. Even people, I think, who hate Brock Lesnar have to admit that when he shows up, there's just a different feeling. Because he's not on television every single week. He's only around when he needs to be around. And I think, at least initially, they should follow the same blueprint for The Fiend. We don't need to see him on TV every single week. People are still talking about that entrance at SummerSlam a week ago. They're going to continue to talk about it. I don't know what his next program is going to be. It probably is too early to go to him and Aleister Black. I know they were kind of teasing it on Twitter. I mean, I still say that, you know, for all the people saying he doesn't need a championship. All right, you're probably right. He doesn't need a championship, but I wouldn't mind seeing him win the championship and go all the way to WrestleMania and then build to something with him and Aleister Black. I think it's too early to go to The Fiend and Aleister Black, because I wouldn't beat either one of them yet. Let them both keep winning until finally they've beaten everybody in their path. Now they go head-to-head. Something's got to give. Somebody has to win, and somebody has to lose. But that's a match you could save, I think, for WrestleMania, unless they want to build to The Fiend and The Demon when Balor comes back. But you could always do that at Survivor Series or the Royal Rumble. So I have no problem with him not being on the show. And also, let me just address this, because I saw some people, and a couple of people on Twitter asked me about this. And that means that there are at least some people who are buying into this nonsense. I noticed that the entrance for The Fiend that they had put on their YouTube channel, WWE, was edited, and they took out, I think, the lantern part. They kind of took that chunk out of it, and there were people thinking, well, that's the end of the lantern. They're already fucking with the character, or somebody complained, or it's too, you know, it's not PG enough for them, or he got in trouble. There's one person who said, oh, did he get in trouble? And I laughed. What can you do in that situation but just laugh? And then I pointed out to this person that just the other day on Twitter, after all of this went down, I don't remember if it was Wednesday or Thursday, whichever day it was, on WWE's official Twitter account, they tweeted out a photo of The Fiend holding the lantern. So if the lantern was such an offensive thing and they were trying to get rid of it and edit it out of everything, don't you think they wouldn't be tweeting out photos of it on their social media? So don't believe everything you hear. The lantern is fine. Bray is not in trouble. He's not in the doghouse. And if anything, it seems like they're giving him a lot more creative freedom than they give to a lot of other people. Which I think is great. And I think that's a great sign for the future of this character. Now, one idea that I was talking about this with Keller on his SmackDown post-show on Tuesday, I would love to see Mr. Rogers Bray, you know, the sweater-wearing version of Bray Wyatt appear exclusively in the Firefly Funhouse segments. Hopefully they can continue those. And that's a great tool they have in their arsenal, and why The Fiend does not have to be on TV every week. You can have The Fiend only appear now and then, but get Bray Wyatt on television every week if you want to. Just put him in the Firefly Funhouse. Have him do other segments as himself. And talk about The Fiend and tease The Fiend without actually showing him and having him show up every week. But I pitched this idea a while ago, and I pitched it with, you know, on Tuesday with Wade as well. I like the idea of each time he beats a new opponent, every time he vanquishes one of his opponents, like he did with Finn at SummerSlam. The next time we see the Firefly Funhouse, we see a new character or a new puppet in their likeness added to the Firefly Funhouse. So maybe in this case it would be a demon puppet. It's almost like their soul is now trapped inside this Firefly Funhouse. They become a new character. I like that idea. It's kind of creepy. And it's a different take on things, and it introduces some new characters, some new puppets to the Funhouse segments, which I hope continue. His theme song is totally just badass, and you can listen to it right now in Spotify and Apple Music. It's called Let Me In by WWE and Code Orange. Interesting little side story here. I'm sure some of you saw it in Newsweek this week. Code Orange is the band also that performed Aleister Black's theme song live on that one NXT TakeOver special, that awesome entrance that he had. But the story behind this is that Bray started following the band on Twitter a number of months ago, and they had already been following him. So they decided to DM him one day and say, hey, we think we can work together. Hit us up and let us know what you think. That got the conversation rolling. They started talking on the phone, and they decided to go ahead and record the song that we now hear, totally independent of WWE. WWE didn't even know that they were doing it. And their attitude was, if they use it, great. WWE doesn't often use a lot of outside work like that, and they have their in-house thing with CFOs, who does all their music now. But their attitude was great. If they use it, terrific, and if not, that's okay too. The one thing that they and Bray agreed on is that they wanted to somehow incorporate his old theme song, Live in Fear, because they thought it was just such a great song and they didn't want to completely abandon it. And once Bray heard the finished product, he texted them and told them, man, this is going to be my song, period. That's it. Because as I said, WWE uses CFOs for all of their music now in-house, but I guess Bray fought for it and persuaded them to let them use it, let him in. And they only found out very shortly, the band did, before SummerSlam, that the song was even being used. This was almost like a kind of a last-minute thing. And I'm glad it was. I've had this song on repeat now for days. As of Friday, it had climbed to number 2 on the iTunes soundtrack chart, behind only the song Shallow by Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. I still have not seen that movie, although I hear good things about it. One last note, Brock Lesnar is one of the many big names being advertised for SmackDown's Fox debut on October 4th, the 20th anniversary special of SmackDown. Goldberg is being advertised, Sting is being advertised. It could just be a one-time appearance for Brock, him and all the other legends, but there's still reports that Fox wants Brock Lesnar on Friday nights. They want him on SmackDown Live. Poor Kofi. As one of our moderators, Yvonne, in the Facebook group said the other day, don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. Time for your weekly dose of the RSPW Rewind. I started a new feature last week digging up old posts on the RSPW news group to highlight, and this week's post is quite timely, given the end of my SummerSlam countdown last week. The number one greatest SummerSlam match of all time was Bret Hart against Owen Hart in a steel cage match for the WWF title. Well, this post is from September 13th, 1994, less than a month after that match, with the headline, "No More of This Stupid Hart Feud." This is in 94. This person was sick to death of the sibling rivalry. Thoralf Pollett is this person's name. Thoralf. That's his, it's a very unique name. He says, just read in RSPW that the Hart feud will rule the main event at Survivor Series. If there will be a tag team match, Bret Hart and the British Bulldog against Owen Hart and the Anvil, which of course turned out not to be the case. By the way, Thoralf was wrong. I'm shocked. Anyway, he continues, that's okay, but let it be the last one. If there will be another Bret versus Owen match, you better forget it. This feud sucks already. For months, that it really hurts. Clearly, English is not his first language. Does WWF Does WWF has no more ideas or no good stuff to do? What have we done? We really don't deserve this. Imagine thinking that getting a Bret Hart versus Owen Hart feud was so bad that the fans don't deserve it, like it's some sort of punishment, like a disease. If only Thoralf had a copy of his Gray's Almanac, his Gray Sports Almanac, and could see 25 years into the future, he would be begging for Bret Hart versus Owen Hart. I haven't seen the cage match for now. SummerSlam will be aired here this Saturday, he says, but I hope it was the last single match. Signed, Thoralf, the real Alf Pollett. The real Alf, like the one that had his own sitcom on NBC? The Alien? Is that the Alf that we're talking about here? Because I'm pretty sure, given his email address listed here, it ends in DE, that Thoralf lived in Germany. I don't remember Alf being German. Chris Peralt responded in the thread, Having been through the Hogan Earthquake, Hogan Slaughter feuds among countless others that got main event play, I still consider a Hart feud a breath of fresh air. Don't forget, if it worked out the way Vinny wanted it, we would be seeing Luger with the belt. Luckily for Hart fans like me, they used the most overused gimmick, the Proud American, and we won't have to be subjected to what would have been Hogan clone feuds. I'll take anything involving a Hart or Michaels over what we had through the Hogan era. And finally here, another poster, Ideen, replied with this. You're absolutely right. This feud is boring me to death and is one of the worst that I have seen this year. And believe me, there have been many disasters this year. I wished the feud would end at WrestleMania 10, but it didn't. And after that, I got so tired of it and especially pissed when they brought that no-talent piece of garbage, Jim the Stiff Neidhart, in, only to disgrace this debacle of a feud. Most feuds last two or three pay-per-views, and sometimes even only once, but this damn feud dates back to the Survivor Series, has now gone six pay-per-views. It is disgusting, and Survivor Series won't sell. Those tag matches never work since the WWF has less talent, if any, than ever before. I say it's a safe bet that Survivor Series might just do a lower buy rate than King of the Ring's pathetic 0.73, and I hope it happens. In fact, Survivor Series did not do worse than the King of the Ring that year, I should point out, but it did do worse than SummerSlam. I shudder to think what would have carried that company. You know, when I think back to that time period, what would have carried that company through 94 were it not for the Bret Hart-Owen Hart program? I mean, maybe Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, but, you know, Shawn wasn't really doing much wrestling until the summer. He was kind of on sabbatical almost, at least between WrestleMania and SummerSlam he was. Luger? I mean, Luger was a failure. Diesel wasn't ready. Backlund didn't turn until July. Then he won the title in November just to drop it to Diesel. You know, crazy heel Mr. Backlund could have had a short run with the championship. Not that short. Not 3 days. But, you know, maybe through WrestleMania. I love that match that he had with Bret on Superstars for the title in 94, where he turned heel after. What a great match. Great match, great angle. But their I Quit match at WrestleMania 11 sucked. Oh, God, did that match suck. I remember my cable went out right at the finish, too, like SummerSlam last weekend when the network kept lagging on me. My cable went out when Bret first... I want to say it was when Backlund had Bret in the chicken wing. Because Bret won with the chicken wing. I think he won by putting Backlund's own hold on him. And I want to say that it was when Backlund maybe got him in the chicken wing or was trying to, and then the cable went out. I got like a blue screen. And of course, I'm freaking out because, oh, I can't miss... The finish is coming. I can't miss the finish. And then when the signal came back on, the match was over. Bret's music is playing. He's posing. I'm like, what the hell happened? Actually, it came back on and we saw Bret, or Backlund rather, being interviewed, I think, by Todd Pettengill in the aisleway. He was acting all crazy. What else is new? I see the light or something. I had no idea what happened. And this is back before they showed, you know, 15,000 replays of everything. So anyway, that's my memory of that. But there you have it. More wrestling fans whining, dating back 25 years. Yet more proof that this is hardly a new phenomenon. Suck it, Thoralf. That was a great feud. Get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jordan, from Toronto. WWE just uploaded a clip from their SummerSlam watch-along live stream of Matt Riddle talking about his backstage encounter with Goldberg. Matt Riddle has never been shy with his opinion of Goldberg, but as far as I know, this is the first time the WWE has ever officially acknowledged the beef between the two of them. If WWE plays their cards right, and both guys were on board, do you think there is the potential for a future big match between the two? If so, Riddle has to go over, right? Be careful with that statement. You would think that would be the right thing to do, but no, he actually does not have to go over, because WWE is always going to, well, it's not always about the younger, newer guys. Sometimes you got a big name in there who's maybe being paid a lot of money, and, you know, They end up getting the spotlight on them in the end. So, is this a match, if they were both on board, that I would like to see? I really, you know, I don't really need to see Goldberg being in the ring anymore, although I expect that we have not seen the last of him in the ring. And he looked great for the 2 minutes he was in there against Dolph Ziggler, but, you know, how much of that was just the fact that Dolph Ziggler is amazing when it comes to selling, you know, big moves like that? So, of course, he sold those spears like death. He doesn't weigh a lot, so he went up easily enough with the jackhammer, made Goldberg look like he had turned the clock back 20 years, but it was a short match. Ziggler sold his ass off for him, so of course Goldberg was going to look good. He looked like a wrecking machine. It actually would not be a bad match for him to go out on. It'd be a hell of a lot better than that Saudi Arabia match. But if both guys were on board, you know, I think they could put something compelling together. Yeah. Yeah, I think that could work. I still would rather, you know, Riddle and Lesnar. I think there's something there with Riddle and Lesnar. They've got to build Riddle up on the main roster because a lot of people don't know who he is. But, yeah, he has shown that he's a very outspoken guy. And the idea that WWE would clip that and put that on their YouTube channel, that's not an accident. That's not done on accident. So the people saying, oh, he should keep his mouth shut, he's going to get himself in trouble. You know, clearly WWE is endorsing all of this. They probably love it. It creates a stir for them on social media and on YouTube. It gets views. You don't think they knew what they were doing when they put him in there for that watch-along? I said the week before SummerSlam, I said I might have to pause my SummerSlam stream and go see what Matt Riddle is going to say, because he's probably going to be doing live commentary on that watch-along for Goldberg's match. And I believe he did. I was having other issues with my stream, so I was distracted. I didn't get a chance to watch it live, the Riddle stuff. But yeah, he was going off on Goldberg and mocking him and everything like you would expect. You know, and he's building these potential matches for himself. It's not a bad thing for him to be doing. But I think that the real potential there is in Lesnar, who's going to need new opponents. That's just a reality. Brock Lesnar is not retiring. Goldberg, every match could be his last. Brock Lesnar is going nowhere. Brock Lesnar is getting paid a lot of money. He still has value left, but I think you need to get him in there with some new opponents. Well, who are those new opponents going to be? Let's say he moves over to SmackDown and he destroys Kofi Kingston and wins the championship, or even if he doesn't. Who do you match him up with? What are you going to do? You going to put him in there with Aleister Black and have him kill Aleister Black in 5 minutes? Randy Orton, that match has been done. Samoa Joe, well, he's on Raw, I guess, but that match has been done. Daniel Bryan, that match has been done. Roman Reigns, that match has been done to death. It's like, you don't have a lot of options for this guy. Matt Riddle, you know, when he eventually makes his way up to the main roster. I'm telling you, right, it's so perfect. The setup is so perfect. It's almost like Austin calling Bret Hart out on television for months in the lead up to their first match at Survivor Series. He had to come out and taunt Bret on television every week and do promos and talk about, if you put the letter S in front of Hitman, you've got my exact thoughts about Bret Hart. And Bret Hart is the slimy substance that runs out of the south end of a chicken. And all the different things that Austin would say about Bret coaxing him to come out of retirement. It was great. And it built to this match. And it turned into this great feud. You know, they had that classic match at WrestleMania the following year. You know, Matt Riddle, I think, should continue to be outspoken. And they should incorporate that into his gimmick. And who knows, maybe it turns him heel. Maybe people get sick of hearing his voice. I know some people are already sick of hearing his voice. But I think there's potentially money there. You know, and don't forget, they come from a similar background with, you know, them having both fought in the UFC and all that, so they have that in common. They're both great athletes. So I think maybe the way to go is to eventually, when he's ready to be called up, he gets called up, and he starts calling out Brock. And it's not an immediate thing. Little comments here and there, kind of like what Ziggler was doing with Goldberg. He dropped little pot shots at him on TV every week until Goldberg finally got sick of it and he showed up on TV. All it takes is you get Riddle on TV, you start giving him wins and establishing him, and, you know, he drops little digs here and there about Brock Lesnar. Where's Brock at? Is he working this week? And all this kind of stuff. I want to retire him. He's been saying it for years. He wants to retire Brock Lesnar. I don't see how you don't do that match at some point. You've got both these guys under contract. Brock's going to need new opponents. You know, this guy comes from a legitimate fighting background. How do you not eventually build to this match? I don't even care who wins. It's just, it would be incredibly stupid. if they don't build to a Brock Lesnar-Matt Riddle match at some point. Because you'll have on one side the guys who hate Matt Riddle. And they can't wait to see him get thrown around and get his ass handed to him. And on the other hand, you have people who probably like Matt Riddle or are sick of Brock Lesnar. And they want to see somebody go toe-to-toe with Brock and maybe throw him around a little bit. The way Cesaro probably could, but we're never going to get that match. So this will be the next best thing. Riddle and Goldberg I'm less enthusiastic about because you do it. Yeah, I get the sense Goldberg probably wouldn't want to. I don't think he likes Matt Riddle very much. As Riddle said when they confronted each other backstage, Goldberg said something to the effect of, you and I have like stuff to talk about. And Riddle was being Riddle. He was probably laughing and saying bro a million times. He said, oh, bro. And Goldberg was like, I'm not your bro. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of respect there. But for the right amount of money, hey. Maybe in Saudi Arabia one of these years. We'll get Goldberg against Matt Riddle. Chase from Rapid City, South Dakota. On last week's show, you mentioned how you couldn't believe all the kickouts in the NXT TakeOver match between Johnny Gargano and Adam Cole, but you did say you could believe all of Gargano's kickouts at TakeOver New York. Where do you begin to draw the line? Are there certain moves that just should not never be kicked out of? If so, what are those moves? It's not as simple. I don't have a list of moves in front of me where it's like, okay, here's my checklist, and here are the moves that you just never kick out of, and here are the moves that are okay to kick out of. You just sort of feel it. And in those matches, the kickouts that they did, and you know, the dramatic kickouts, they worked. And they didn't bother me the way that they bothered other people. This was the match. This was their third match. And it was almost like having three matches in one because of the 2 out of 3 false step, right? So you had a straight match, you had a street fight, you had a cage match. It went almost an hour in total, longer than it really should have. And some of the moves that they built to in this match, whether it was, I think, a Canadian destroyer off the top rope or, like, just, you know, crazy shit that should be protected and should not be kicked out of. It's the kind of move that you can end the match on. And I guess in that match, it was just one too many for my liking. And it got to a point where I just had this feeling of, eh, they just jumped the shark. You know, I don't know why. It's just how I felt. I didn't feel that way in the TakeOver New York match. I don't always feel that way when I watch New Japan. You know, if I'm watching the G1, you could say the same thing. Salamasa, you praise the G1. Do they not kick out of big moves in the G1? Does Okada not kick out of everything under the sun? Yeah, it happens there too. But the way the matches are structured, you know, sometimes it works. And look, there are times where even I'm sitting here and I'm like, okay, come on. Like, that should have been the finish. What the hell? But by the time the match is over, it didn't really detract from my enjoyment of it. If it did, I would say so. You can't. It's not one size fits all. We're not all fucking robots here. You watch a match, you just feel it. You just know. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. There's no prerequisite, you know, predetermined list of moves or anything like that. Although, I would put probably a top rope Canadian destroyer on a list, if I ever had one, of moves that should never be kicked out of. It's just, there are just some moves that, frankly, are ridiculous to think that. And the worst, here's the worst. You will occasionally have a match, whether it's WWE, whether it's Ring of Honor or New Japan. There is that one move. There's that one big spot that you just watch that and you're like, that's it. It's over. This guy's dead. And they kick out. They get a shoulder up. And you can even hear it in the crowd sometimes where the crowd almost groans like, come on. But then when they get to the finish, it's a move that isn't nearly as devastating. And they win with that. And you could argue, well, they're just wearing the guy down. It's like a video game, right? You're wearing the guy's energy bar down. So you may hit a big move early in the match and he kicks out, but it took a lot out of him. And in the end, you win with like a fucking lariat or something. But it's just so dumb when you have a match like that and you have this big, elaborate maneuver that doesn't finish the job. But in the end, it's a clothesline, right? Or it's a top rope elbow or something very pedestrian that wins the match. I hate stuff like that. But it's just the feeling. I don't have a list of moves. It's just the way I felt about the match. And it was a good match, but it was probably the weakest out of the three that they've had together at these TakeOver shows. You know, it's just after a while, you see the same stuff over and over again. And it just gets to a point where it's like, this is ridiculous. They have jumped the shark here. Lucas from Knoxville, Tennessee, buy or sell on the idea of WWE Studios releasing a horror movie starring Bray Wyatt's Fiend. I would buy, you know, the Fiend character would be a better fit, if we're being honest, for the silver screen and not the TV screen. And if they ever did that, I'm all here for it. I'll be the first person in the theater or buying the digital download or however it's released. But I think Bray missed his calling. I mean, I'm not saying that he's, you know, Al Capone. I'm not saying he's Al Capone or De Niro in their prime or anything like that, but he, the way his mind works, and all of the little character details, now all of the Fiend stuff, he should have been an actor. His creativity, I think, would be much better utilized as an actor and not a wrestler. I mean, wrestlers are actors, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean? Anyway, LC from Rochester, New York, what are your top three? I remember where I was when I saw that live moments in wrestling. For example, my number one spot would go to the dual broadcast where Shane McMahon walked out on Nitro and Vince was on Raw. I remember it because I got in trouble since my mother wanted me to take the garbage out at that very moment. And because there was no DVR, I would not dare leave as my brother had Nitro on one TV and Raw was on the TV in the other room. And I was standing in the hallway watching both and refused to move. That is, until my mother threw a shoe at me. What about you? So I thought about this. I mean, there's a lot of moments like that where I kind of remember where I was. Maybe I was even at the show. Yeah, I've been to, at this point, I don't know, seven or eight WrestleManias, I think. But the three that stood out to me, and a lot of them go back to when you were a kid or when you were a younger wrestling fan. The first one is Ric Flair winning the Royal Rumble in 92. Because, and I've told the story before about being at school. We were on break during recess or something, and there was a phone booth in the hallway downstairs. And I come downstairs, and I see all these kids huddled in and around the phone booth, and I can't imagine what the hell they're doing in there. So I go over, and I ask somebody, and they're like, oh, you know, he's calling the wrestling hotline. And I hear them talking amongst themselves that Ric Flair is going to win the Royal Rumble. I had no idea how he knew this, but I remember watching the Rumble pay-per-view live at my grandfather's house because they had cable and we still didn't at home. I didn't get cable until 95. So all the stuff I was watching was on tapes that they taped for me or I'd be at their house. It was a lot easier once I finally got cable. My first pay-per-view was the Survivor Series in 95. I mean, I had seen, that wasn't my first pay-per-view that I watched, but the first one I was actually able to watch at home in my own house wasn't until the Survivor Series in 95. And I've been watching wrestling since, oh my God, 86, 87. Anyway, I remember watching the Rumble live at my grandfather's house and saying, Ric Flair is going to win the Royal Rumble. And when Flair actually won the Royal Rumble, I felt like I was the smartest guy in the world. It was like, I was so happy. I don't even know who I wanted to actually see win the match, if I was rooting for Hogan or somebody else, but when Flair won, you couldn't surgically remove the smile from my face. I was so happy I'd gotten it right. So I remember that. I remember the Hell in a Cell match between Undertaker and Mankind from the King of the Ring in 98. I remember watching it live at home, and my father was home, and he was watching it with me. He was sitting right behind me. I was on the floor. And when he threw Foley on that first big bump off the cell, we had the same reaction, like holy shit reaction. And I remember turning around and looking at him and look on his face like we couldn't believe it. We thought this guy was dead. So I vividly remember that. And the third one is a sad one, but I remember everything about that night that Owen Hart died. I was watching the pay-per-view from my friend's house. He had the old, you know, the black boxes with the scrambled signal and all that, so I'd go over to his house, and we were watching Over the Edge that night, and I remember when, you know, they were about to have the Intercontinental title match with the Blue Blazer and the Godfather, and they came back, and they have the graphic on the screen, and you hear Jim Ross basically stuttering and saying, we got big problems out here. And I don't know that I picked up on it at first. I might have been talking to my friend or something. They show the Owen Hart promo from earlier with Kevin Kelly, and then they cut to the crowd shot, and they explain what's going on. And I remember we're watching this, and you know, we couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe this was happening. And we're just kind of talking amongst ourselves, like it's not, I don't know that it's real to us at that point. And I remember saying to him, oh boy, you know, if he's really hurt, that's a hell of a lawsuit that this company is going to have on their hands. Like, we're talking like that. Not at all, I think, thinking that they're going to announce later that this guy is dead. And when they did, later in the show, because it was a couple more matches before they made the announcement on TV, it was just, I mean, that's, I stuck around for the rest of the pay-per-view, although I don't think, it was very quiet in the room. I don't really think we were talking. And I was waiting because when the event was over, I think he gave me the tape. I still have the tape. I have the VHS tape up in my closet. And I put, you know, I used to put all the labels, I would have fixed the labels on the side of the tape and everything, and I still have it up there. I remember I writing WWF Over the Edge 1999, I put the date on there. And then I drew like a little tombstone on the sticker. So that anytime I would look at the tape, I knew exactly what it was. But I remember when the event was over, I walked home because he lived maybe 6 or 7 blocks away from me. And that's when it really hit me. I had met Owen less than a year earlier. You guys have seen the photos on my Twitter. And it was a brief meeting. I mean, we were in the luxury box with him probably for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And it was the only time I ever met him, and he took a picture with me and was the nicest guy. Could not have been nicer. Everybody's leaving out of the luxury box, you know, Foley and Luna and Mark Henry, to go to the next one. This is in the hour before Raw was about to go on the air. And Owen was the only one who stopped and turned around before he left and said, anybody need pictures? Anybody need pictures? And I don't think anybody even heard him. They were all buzzing and talking to each other, but I saw this and I was almost embarrassed to say anything. And my friend and my mother was there, and she's like, go ahead, say. And I'm like, okay. I said, raised my hand, and he came over, and we took a picture and the whole thing. So my brief experience with Owen was a positive one. And, you know, now I just got done watching a pay-per-view where this guy fell from the ceiling and died. And it's starting to hit me. And I remember keying into the house, and I start, like, you know, the tears are starting, and I can hear the television on upstairs. And I go upstairs, and my brother and my mother are there together, and they're watching the news. The 11 o'clock news just came on, and they're talking, and maybe in the teaser for the news, they were saying a professional wrestler died, but they hadn't really said who it was yet. And I remember walking in, and I think it was my mother who said, hey, a wrestler died. And I just lost it. She couldn't understand what the hell was going on. And then I told her, and it was just, it was awful. And then the newscast came on, and it was the lead story in all the local newscasts, at least here in New York. And this didn't even happen in New York, so I would think throughout the country it was probably the lead story in a lot of newscasts that night. But I just lost it, and that was awful. Yeah, that was a bad night. So those are the three big ones that really stand out to me in my mind. And Billy in Des Moines. We'll end with this. You inadvertently left us with a nice cliffhanger last week on the podcast in regards to steel cage matches versus Hell in a Cell matches. While I agree with you that they're two different matches, you said that if you consider them both cage matches, the best one ever is either Brett versus Owen from SummerSlam 94, or the first Hell in a Cell with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. So, buy or sell on which of the two is the better cage match? SummerSlam 94 or Bad Blood from 97? You know, it really depends on your view, I think, of cage matches. Brett versus Owen was to keep the family out. And at times it felt like a legitimate fight between two brothers to get out of the cage. Hell in a Cell in 97 was conceived to keep the two men in, to prevent Shawn Michaels from being able to run away from The Undertaker. And I guess also to keep DX out as well, but more so, I think, to keep Michaels in and to pay the price for tormenting The Undertaker the way that he had been doing and hitting him in the head with a chair and all the things they did to The Undertaker leading up to that match. Both are two of the best matches in company history. I loved the mayhem after the SummerSlam match with Anvil knocking Bulldog and his wife over the railing and him and Owen locking themselves in the cage with Brett, beating away all the brothers to climb, yeah, as they're trying to climb inside. Start to finish, it was just 40 minutes or so of just drama. And the way the crowd hung on to every, I guess the near falls, quote unquote, in that match were every attempt to escape the cage. And they just hung on and built to every single one. It was just, it's something fun to go back and watch. Shawn and The Undertaker just had fun matches together. And Shawn Michaels was such a dick. And you wanted just to see him get his ass handed to him in the worst way. And, you know, on top of that, it included the debut of one of the longest lasting characters in the history of that company. And still to this day, I maintain the greatest single character debut in WWE history. And that is Kane. That match had blood. The other one did not because it couldn't. They had to work around that. So I love both matches. You're asking me to choose between what I think is the greatest steel cage match ever in WWE and the greatest, what I think is the greatest Hell in a Cell match. I'm buying on Brett and Owen at SummerSlam, and I'm selling on Hell in a Cell. I can go back and watch that cage match anytime. I could stop recording here today and go back and watch it again. And there are going to be people who hear that and go, I don't understand. Like, I watched it. It was so boring. I didn't think it was boring. I thought it was dramatic, and I thought it was art. So I can go back and watch it anytime I want to. And to me, that's the hallmark right there of a great match. I can watch it, and I personally can never get bored. Both matches tell great stories, but I just cannot bring myself to vote against that cage match. So of the two, if you put a gun to my head, I'm voting for Brett versus Owen. We are counting down the eight best matches in the career of Rey Mysterio. Why eight? Because we only have 7 weeks until Sound Off 619 drops on September 29th. And on that episode, I will reveal the top two matches. So that's why I kept it to eight total. Credit to Too Cold Steve-O on Twitter for giving me the idea for this. I always enjoy hearing ideas from you guys. I can't always use them. But with 619 coming up and the SummerSlam countdown coming to an end, it just seemed to make sense. And hey, maybe if enough of you guys tweet at Rey Mysterio on Twitter, maybe we can get him to record a little special intro to episode 619. Rey Mysterio has wrestled a lot of matches in his career. He started wrestling when he was 14 years old. That was the same year that Hulk Hogan wrestled Randy Savage at WrestleMania. The same year that the Mega Powers exploded. 1989. Rey Mysterio made his debut inside a Mexican church. And he has wrestled all over the world. He's wrestled for AAA. He's wrestled for CMLL. After WCW went under, he wrestled for WCW, wrestled for WWE, Lucha Underground. He's been a World Heavyweight Champion, Royal Rumble winner, and is a surefire first ballot Hall of Famer. This man changed the game for smaller wrestlers. We kicked this thing off with number 8 in the countdown, a match that many people were upset and surprised not to see in my list of the top 10 SummerSlam matches, and one of the best opening pay-per-view matches that you will ever see. Rey Mysterio versus Kurt Angle from SummerSlam 2002. Rey had signed with WWE in June of 2002, this after WCW went under the year before, and Rey had been unmasked. He was wrestling for a while without his mask on. And he came to WWE, and Vince McMahon wanted the mask back on him. Probably he saw all the money that he can make from merch and selling masks. But it ain't that easy, because the mask is a very sacred thing in Mexico. It's a big deal to be unmasked and to reveal yourself. And if you lose your mask, you can't just start wearing it again. So at the request of Vince McMahon, Rey Mysterio had to go to the official Lucha Libre Commission to ask permission to begin wearing the mask again, which they granted. Now, had they said no, he wouldn't have been able to wear a mask. Or at least, maybe a different kind of mask. I don't know how that would have... Or maybe Vince would have said, well, the hell with the stupid commission. You're wearing a mask no matter what, damn it. But he went and asked for permission, and permission was granted. And he debuted on SmackDown in July with a win over Chavo Guerrero. And then he began a program with Kurt Angle. He got a pinfall win over Kurt in a tag team match on TV in the lead-up to what would be his very first pay-per-view match in WWE that year at SummerSlam. That SummerSlam in 2002 is widely considered to be maybe the best top-to-bottom SummerSlam show of all time. And that opener is just one of the reasons why. So Kurt comes out first, and very strange, you know, at that time to see somebody like Kurt Angle coming out to curtain jerk on a pay-per-view, but there he is, and he's in the ring waiting for Ray. Ray's music is playing, and there's no Ray. All of a sudden, we see Ray, he's on the apron, behind Kurt, hits a springboard hurricanrana, and just like that, we're off to the races. And the match was a sprint, under 10 minutes. This match lasted, I think, about 9 minutes and 40 seconds, so it was not a long match at all. But it was all action, which a Rey Mysterio match ought to be. He hits Angle with a monkey flip, he misses a 619 early on. Kurt wisely tried to ground Rey, put him in a single leg crab, more like a lion tamer. Belly to belly by Kurt. Straps come down. Rey counters an Angle slam into an arm drag takeover, and Kurt now is on the floor. He's outside the ring. Rey says, well, we're going to go for a dive. And as he hits the ropes to come off for a dive, referee Jimmy Cordero stops him. And the fans are not happy about that. They make that very clear. They are not happy. So Cordero turns back around to turn his attention to Kurt outside. He's telling him to get back in. Rey says, you know what? Fuck this. He hits the ropes anyway, and he does a dive over the referee and out onto Angle to a big pop on the floor. Springboard leg drop back inside by Rey. That gets a near fall. Mysterio springboards backwards off the ropes, lands on Kurt's shoulders, but Kurt dumps him down and goes for an ankle lock. Rey manages to navigate out of it, gets Kurt in the ropes, hits the 619, West Coast pop, near fall. Kurt ends up sitting on the top rope. Rey climbs up onto his shoulders, spins his body. He tries for a hurricanrana off the top, but Kurt does not fly over. Instead, they both land on the mat. Kurt immediately locks in the ankle lock. He drags Rey to the center of the ring. Rey's fighting and fighting, but in the end, he has no choice but to tap out. One of the best sub-10-minute matches in WWE history. Maybe the best, frankly. I mean, when you think of like matches under 10 minutes, like really short matches, there's been so many of them, it's impossible to remember them all. But I think of that Owen Hart match with the 1-2-3 kid in the King of the Ring in 94. I mean, that was like a 3-minute match, but people still talk about it to this day. Goldberg and Brock Lesnar, to use a more recent example, WrestleMania 33. That thing was a sprint. From the opening bell, it went 6 minutes, which is long for a Goldberg, even a Lesnar match, but especially a Goldberg match. And I thought that was a great match. That was exactly the kind of match those two guys should have had. And it was only 6 minutes. But I would say this match here is probably the best when I think of the, you know, all the sub-10-minute matches in WWE history and on pay-per-view. If this isn't number one, then it's got to be, you know, it's near number one if it isn't number one. Now, the following month, the two of them had a rematch on SmackDown. Kurt won that match as well. He hit an Angle slam off the top rope. That was the same show. If you want to go back on the network and watch it, September 12, 2002. Where before the match, Kurt cuts a promo on Rey and says, "You're a boy in a man's world, and he's a man who loves to play with boys." And everybody laughs, so he tries again, and he just keeps digging and digging and digging the hole deeper. It was a funny promo that I suspect some people today wouldn't find so funny, or at least enough people who would probably make a stink about it, but, you know, back then people didn't get so offended by every little thing. It was a fun promo. And the two of them had great chemistry in the ring. Kurt was an absolute machine back then. And although he may have lost, you know what? Hanging with a heavyweight like Kurt Angle did good for Rey Mysterio. And it established, because he had only debuted in July. So he was in there with Kurt right out of the gate. It's not like he was wrestling cruiserweights. And it established that he wasn't just a cruiserweight. He could hang with the top stars in the company. So that's match number 8 to begin our countdown, short as it was. You know, Rey has had better matches. So I could not rank this match higher than number 8 based on the list that I put together, which I'm very excited to share with all of you. But look, consider how many matches that Rey Mysterio has had in his career. Number 8 ain't a bad place to be. And we'll continue with number 7 coming up next week. Keep following me on Twitter, subbing to the YouTube channel, all the different ways to keep up with what's going on and support the podcast, PayPal, of course, Audible, Manscaped. Very happy to be doing more advertising with them. It is a product that is a quality product, and I do not mind at all talking more about it. We have a predominantly male audience here, and, you know, we're not talking about medications or pills or things to chew and all this other stuff, which is fine, but it's a men's grooming product. And who among us doesn't want to, groom whatever part of our body every now and then? So, it's one way to support the podcast. If you do, please use the code SOLOMONSTER, and you can get your 20% off and free shipping. And everybody who uses the code, I cannot impress upon you how important that is for the podcast. Because it just shows them that we have a lot of people who are willing to give this a shot. So, by all means, please, if you think you might have a need for that. And they have a lot of products. If you go on their website, you know, it's a lot of different kinds of product that you can use. And that discount is good for any order that you put in there, not just for one particular kind of product or anything like that. So please use that code as well. Yes, the Lyft code, for those who have asked, is still valid. So if you want to open a Lyft account and get money off your first ride, you can use the code SOLOMONSTER on Lyft. It's funny, somebody asked me one day, they go, hey, you know, every time I use your code on Lyft, do you get like a free ride or something? And I'm like, honestly, no, I don't. The people who use the code get a lot more than I do. What I get is, I think typically it's $2 off. And it's crazy too, because it expires after a few weeks. So if, let's say, you take a ride with my code, right, you may get your first ride free. I mean, some people have said they got a free ride. Some people said they got $5 off. Whatever it is, it's great for you. I usually get $2 off, and it expires after a few weeks. If I don't use it, it goes away. And even worse, all the people out of the country, in the UK or other places, I think the code might work for you, but then I get an email saying, well, it looks like somebody has used, you know, taken a ride with your code out of the country. And unfortunately, we can't support that for you, and so I end up getting nothing out of it. But if you guys get something out of it, that's great. And so for the couple of people earlier in the week who asked me about that, yes, the code is still valid. I don't plug it all the time. But if you open, I think you have to open a new account. Put that promo code in there, SOLOMONSTER, and you can get money off your first ride. I use Lyft a lot, way more than Uber. So whenever I need a car for anything like that, Lyft is the one that I go to, and I have found their drivers to be, you know, great by and large, and I've had no issues with them. So hopefully it will be useful to you as well. Thank you for all the support. I will be back next Sunday for episode 614 of the podcast. Please sub to the YouTube channel, 52,000 strong on there. There'll be more content and clips from this show and maybe some extra content, you never know, going up on the channel this week. So please subscribe. And until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The SOLOMONSTER sounds off.
EC3 lost to Tyler Breeze.
I tweeted, that sounds like something you would put on the tombstone of your career.
They never should have called him up in the first place if they had no plans for him. I haven't seen a career fade this fast since Jussie Smollett.
The SOLOMONSTER sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the SOLOMONSTER on Twitter @SOLOMONSTER.
SOLOMONSTER.
SOLOMONSTER.
Put that cigarette out.
SOLOMONSTER sounds off.